Tonight on The Download, the Daily Line's Mike Boucher. From one-off hospitality, Donnie Medea and Paul Kahn. And novelist Scott Spencer. Now, here's your host, a man who didn't buy a sweetened beverage today, Justin Kaufman.
I'm fasting. I'm out of the sweetened beverage game. You win. You win, Cook County. I'll be healthy. And you won't get any money. Oh, but I could go for a Dr. Pepper right now. No, I'm out. I'm out. I'm fasting. Unless, of course, it's Cherry Coke, right? I mean, there's nothing wrong with that product. It might be the best drink invented. I wonder if we could lobby Cook County government to say all sweetened beverages except cherry-flavored cola. I mean, I don't want it to just be one brand. I don't mind a Coke and Pepsi, although I have my preference. But the idea being that there's just, I mean, Cherry Coke, nectar of the gods.
What about when you go to a movie at River Reef and they have those fancy those Coke things where you can push?
I go Coca-Cola, flavored, cherry, push. I'm a Cherry Coke guy, live or die.
I try a bunch of. I do Dr. Pepper into Coke into
you
Diet
the orange
Coke
vanilla,
into Orange Crush.
The yeah, Diet Orange Vanilla. you are who they're going after. They're like they threw your picture up, Pete, on the PowerPoint at the Cook County Board meeting a couple months ago. This guy, we need 80 cents from this guy. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Beautiful Wednesday, although rainy. Reports of power outages in the neighborhood, but of course, you know what? Right now, we'll pay attention to the weather, but, you know, August 2nd. That's the best I can say. We got a great show lined up tonight. It is Wednesday, so that means that Greg Flamm will be here in the 10 o'clock hour for Swap Meet, one of my favorite segments where we essentially evaluate your commemorative memorabilia, your knickknacks, your tchotchkes, your junk. Before you go and put it out there in a garage sale in the 25 cents and under bin, maybe try it out here and see if it's worth anything. Greg Flamm's been with us for a year plus now. Wednesday night's always fun. Love to talk to the listeners. 312-981-7200. Greg coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. In the 9 o'clock hour, Scott Spencer's going to be here, the longtime novelist, National Book Award finalist. I mean, this guy, he's got 11 novels. His first novel was in 1973, one of the best writers out there. And he is in town, special. He's at Bookends and Beginnings tomorrow night. When I saw he was coming in, I'm like, done. Love to talk. He's got a new novel, River Under the Road. We'll talk with Scott Spencer. That's a big deal. That's a big book to get him in here. If anyone who's paying attention, who pays attention to novels and the world of writing and novelists, Scott Spencer is high up there on the list. Upstate New Yorker who grew up, was born here in Chicago on the South Side. So we'll talk with Scott Spencer coming up in the 9 o'clock hour tonight. In the 8 o'clock hour, Donnie Medea and Paul Kahn from One Off Hospitality. I mean, some of the greatest restaurants that Chicago's ever seen from this company. And Donnie and Paul and their team, everything from Publican in the West Loop to Avec, Blackbird, as Anna talked about. She went there on her birthday. Nico Osteria right here in the River North area, Rush Street area. Big Star Tacos in Wicker Park, right across the street from Violet Hour. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. These guys have created an empire here in Chicago. They are two of the people who are hosting a new, not new, but a charity event that is happening every year, annual charity event for childhood cancer at the Revel Fulton Market. We had those guys in.
I think there is a time in when I spent a day in the Wicker Park area. I went to all three. I had like brunch at Dove's, and then get later. Hey, you know, like, yeah, I can go for a taco. Let's like run over to Big Star, and then go to dinner at the New Publican.
It's great. Yep, it's Wicker Park. They dominated that area.
So good.
Yeah, they are. They're great, and like I said, they're doing a charity event with Tony Montuano and others here in Chicago at Revel coming up on August 7th. So we'll have Paul and Donnie in studio at the big table tonight. And coming up here in the 7:30 spot, Mike Fouché, Daily Line. We talk schools. We heard from the governor during Rokon, but let's Get Mike's take on what's happening in Springfield when it comes to school funding and SB1. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's carry out. Here are today's top stories. Stephen Miller, remember him? The White House aide that kind of looks like an 80s villain? Like a bad cop in 48 Hours with Nick Nolte and Eddie Murphy? Stephen Miller, anybody? Anyway, he briefed the White House press corps today over the new immigration bill that would cut legal immigration in half and set up screenings where more skilled and English-speaking immigrants would get preference. He sparred with CNN's Jim Acosta. During the heated exchange in which Acosta said it seemed as if the administration just wanted immigrants from Britain and Australia, Miller told Acosta that he had a cosmopolitan bias. A cosmopolitan bias. I guess that's better than a Jack Daniels bias. It's a fruity bias. But at play here is this continued notion that the press is elite and they don't speak for the unwashed. It's political rhetoric at best, and at worst, it's gross and divisive. The CNN reporter has a really interesting point that seems to be missed in this argument. Are we changing our immigration core principles? Is the Trump administration redefining the old poem, give us your huddled masses yearning to breathe free? Is it now give us your huddled English-speaking masses that are efficient in iOS and Windows 7? Breathing free optional? Because that's fine, but just change it on the Statue of Liberty, right? I don't know about you, but with the rules set up today as part of this immigration bill and the government that we speak, I'm not sure that my ancestors would be allowed in this country. Think about your ancestors. Something to think about there. The president's also under scrutiny for saying that the head of the Boy Scouts called him to say that his speech at the Jamboree was, quote, it was the greatest speech that was ever made. Wow. The head of the Boy Scouts uses the same hyperbole that the president does? How fitting. How crazy. That doesn't sound like something that was paraphrased. That sounds like a direct quote, right? Except the Boy Scouts say that they didn't make the call. And now the White House says, well, it wasn't the head of the Boy Scouts. It was just troop leaders and others that were at the speech. Oh, so when you say head of the Boy Scouts called you mean Frank from Troop 135 yelled at you as you got in your limo. Cool. All right. Just making sure we're clarified on that. Well, with all that news, the president's actually getting good news from Wall Street. The Dow finished today at over 22,000. Wow, that's unprecedented. That's a new record. So what's it mean? It means we're all rich and the economy is super fun, awesome time. Woo, party at your house. Or does it mean when the market inevitably crashes, it just won't crash that much? Like it'll just be a crash like 18,000? Cool. I just hope Wall Street invests those good numbers into cool fashion trends, right? Like a fatter knot on the tie, or maybe a khaki suit, or the Scaramucci collar, like a little bit more pointed, crisp. But the big takeaway from the new poll that says that less and less Americans are investing in the stock market, prompting one financial analyst to tell the Washington Post that it was, quote, tragic. Tragic that people aren't riding the high? He realizes, right, that many people don't get into the stock market because A, they already did, and it didn't work out so well, 2008. Or B, they just don't have the money to invest in the first place. Tragic. What a Homer thing to say. It's tragic that you don't give us your money, bro. Okay. In weather, it was super hot out today, then it rained. But when it was super hot, it was a perfect day for a slip and slide, wasn't it? If you have one, I suggest you pull it out. Perfect slip and slide weather. In sports, the Cubs put the hurt on the Diamondbacks last night and hope to follow suit tonight. Arrieta's on the mound. He'll be caught by newly acquired catcher Alex Avila, who's kind of looks exactly like Jake Arrieta. So that's weird. The only difference is that Avila is the guy who wears a turtleneck when it's cold. Take it from a Sox fan. He used to come up there in April with a turtleneck on. Who does that? Who wears a turtleneck in baseball? Alex Avila. Also, what does it say about Wilson Contreras that whenever Jake Arrieta pitched, he'd rather pitch to a new catcher that just got acquired than Wilson Contreras? Because wasn't Miggy Montero Arrieta's catcher for a long time? I feel like there's something there that's not being told. Either Arrieta is stubborn and a really, really smart pitcher, or Arrieta is stubborn and a really, really dumb pitcher. Like, I can't figure it out, but there's something in there with he needs his own special catcher. The Cubs are also 9 games above 500. 9 games. Hard to believe that they were a game over or under whatever it was at the break. Amazing. The White Sox got beat again today to go 0-2 in August. They lost 5-1 to the Blue Jays, let J.A. Happ strike him out 10 times. The Sox are still without Yoan Moncada, who's out with a knee bruise after a gruesome collision, but all signs point to a weekend return, at least. And what else can I say about the White Sox? There is a need to fill time, so, what could we say? Tyler Saladino still got that mustache. Their uniforms look crisp, like they look clean, like they were laundered. Yeah, White Sox. That's all I got. All right. The Bears are back in camp today. Look like our QB Mike Glennon is settling in nicely, with his receivers at least. Cam Meredith and Kevin White. White drew applause from the crowd for a circus-like catch. When I hear circus-like catch in the media, I think he was on a dirt bike with like 5 other guys on dirt bikes, and they were all in a metal ball trying to break a world's record for 7 loop-de-loops. All the while trying to catch a football. Am I the only one that thinks that when you think circus? And the whole place smells like elephant dung? No? You know exactly what I'm talking about. Don't act like you don't. Also, 3 days after emergency surgery for an appendectomy, Marcus Wheaton was back in Bourbonnais. Not on the field yet, but watching practice. And that is a good sign. Wait, was he in hospital scrubs or street clothes? Because if it was a hospital gown, then probably he just escaped. But if it's street clothes, good sign. In other football news, college football news, Coach Parsegian died today. The longtime coach at Notre Dame was one of the winningest coaches ever in South Bend. He was also the coach that let Rudy walk onto the squad, which now is the most famous story in college football next to the Mante Teo catfish girlfriend scheme. Yes, there would be no Rudy if it weren't for Coach Parsegian. The current Notre Dame team celebrated his honor by getting arrested, thrown off the team, transferring, or just leaving for the NFL. And that is your current Notre Dame situation. Tonight's the MLS All-Star Game right here in Chicago. Soldier Field will be hopping. Real football takes over for a change at the Soldier Field. But will it be a true football crowd that walks out 3 quarters through the match out of disgust? Hey, only time will tell. And finally tonight, a changing of the guard. A long-time landmark institution of great Chicago history is closing its doors. The Taco Bell next to Wrigley Field. It's like millions of Wrigleyville bros cried out at once. No, now where will I go to go to the emergency bathroom? No. To quote Boys to Men, it's so hard to say goodbye to Wrigleyville gorditas and chalupas. Rest in peace. That's the carryout for August 2nd, 2017. Have no fear. We will be your late night food destination. We've got chalupas. Well, by chalupas, we mean a grilled perch dinner deal. But you know what? You're drunk. You can't tell the difference. All right, coming up, Mike Fouché is here from the Daily Line. We'll talk about the movement in Springfield when it comes to school funding. Interesting. A lot of negotiation was underway when the governor vetoed yesterday. We'll see what that means. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. I love the mayor was on today. The governor was on today. Power game.
Man.
I loved Emmanuel this morning. I think we put it was on Instagram, where he said, they were saying, was Scaramucci the worst chief of staff? They're asking about being a chief of staff. And he said, this is going to get me in trouble. But he said, Dick Morris. I was like, wow, blast from the past. And that would have been when Emmanuel was in the White House, in the Clinton White House. So I was like, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, Dick Morris is a little jittery.
Yeah.
A little jittery. Too much caffeine.
You remember that? Remember when Dick Morris was picked up? He was like, what? He wasn't even a Democrat, was he? He was a Republican, Dick Morris at the time. He kind of waffled.
Yeah. I don't know what he is.
Yeah.
Didn't he write a children's book, too?
I think he did.
I
know he went on to bigger and better things. I mean, he's a pundit on Fox, other places, but.
Was.
But yeah, I remember that. That was crazy. So I guess it put it all in perspective when that was 20 years ago. And so this isn't new when we have chief of staff turmoil. You know, it seems to be cyclical. So how are you, buddy?
Not bad, man.
Yeah?
Yeah, just chilling.
Did you do any slip and slide today? Did you pull the slip and slide out for the new patio furniture?
No slip and slide. You know, we got, man, I don't even really want to get into it. I'm very frustrated.
Uh-oh.
The phone's been ringing, you know, for Mrs. Robb over the past couple of days. Can you go out to the patio and measure this? Can you take the tape measure? Get some of the kids' sidewalk chalk. I need you to X off some.
So there's other.
It looks like a construction site.
Yeah.
You know, right before they're ready to start demolition. I got sidewalk chalk and X's and measurements all over the place.
We're getting
a damn pergola and some furniture. We're getting a pergola and some furniture, and I've been out there for, you know, like 3 hours cumulative measuring this damn thing. Just get the pergola.
Are you a reluctant carpenter like my dad who's like, is it 4/6? It's 3/5.
No, I'm pretty good. Okay on that.
You're decisive.
Yeah.
That's important in carpentry.
This is a pergola. I'm not measuring out a 2x4 to hold up a wall. You know, it's from Menards or Sears or wherever she's ordering it from.
A pergola.
Yeah.
I like it.
Mm-hmm. Just get the damn thing and I'll put it together.
Well, there's going to be a lot of pergola parties over at Martyr's house.
But we are having a taco party with friends
next month.
So.
Nice. All right. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman in studio with us, as he is every Wednesday night. Mike Fouché from the Daily Line to talk Springfield, Cook County.
Woo! Raise the roof.
Chicago politics.
So great.
Good to see you, Mike.
It's great to be here.
Last week we talked to you. You were in Springfield at the new bureau.
I had to phone in.
You had to phone in. How was it? I mean, to be down there during that special session, that really nothing happened.
Well, I mean, there was plenty of stuff that was happening. I mean, the Capitol felt kind of empty most of the time, but... You know, really what was going on was a bunch of posturing. There were a lot of press conferences and there was a certain amount of legislators all going, are we going to do something? You know, there's a lot of eyeballing each other.
OK, so let's talk about this. Early this week, Monday, Governor Rauner did do what he promised. The amendatory vetoed the SB1 where he just essentially voted or vetoed the one part that was for pension pickups for the CPS system.
Well, there were a lot of things that he had in the amendatory veto. The big part was the block grant for the city of Chicago, the pension payments for the teachers in CPS.
Really? The block grant, too.
Yeah. And then also there was a change to a system where you can get credits, school districts can get credits if they're running a TIF program for property taxes, which is, Chicago, but also some other districts, other school districts around the state. And then also some changes to a thing called Hold Harmless, which is a process where if school districts are losing students, that they don't lose the amount of money that they're getting right away.
All of these things.
Which is Chicago. There's other school districts where that matters a lot, too. You know,
but
places
primarily
like East St. Louis and Cairo and Peoria. Yeah, but primarily Chicago.
So, I mean, anything that had the word Chicago anywhere close to it, the mandatory vetoed, right? I mean,
except
for the idea that whatever in the formula that was created, the new formula for funding, Chicago would get a percentage based on whatever the formula was. He was okay with that. It's everything on top of it that was added by Democratic lawmakers.
There are really two big sections here. There is the part which is the formula, which everybody agrees on. Pretty much everyone agrees on what the formula is, Democrats, Republicans. And then there's all this other stuff about payouts to Chicago and how the Hold Harmless stuff works, which affects other schools as well. So, you know, this is really all about Chicago. And, you know, you could say that this is politics, that Rauner is bashing Chicago for the benefit of people south of I-80. But, you know, when I went around, when Ray, our reporter, our editor in Springfield, she and I went and interviewed just a ton of Republicans and legislators and just asking them, you know, what do you think about all this? You know, where are you on it? And again and again and again, we heard from people, legislators, who really did feel and believe that Chicago was getting too much of a bite from state money.
Okay, so let's break that down, because, you know, there has been a sentiment about, and it has been political, the idea of it being advantageous for Republicans to separate Chicago from the rest of the state. And that might just that is, and that's not new.
Yeah.
I mean, Bill Daley talked about it at the publicity club, just the idea that's been going on for decades in the state of Illinois.
Right.
But you're saying it's more than political. There's a belief that it's true, that that Chicago gets more favorable money, bills, anything that's happening in Springfield, there's a more favorable outcome to the city.
And, you know, maybe they do actually, you know, one of the things about politics is that there's all this talk about what people believe. And, you know, you have to take them at their word that they actually believe it. It could be that they're motivated for other reasons in order to do that. They want to get more money for their districts, you know, okay, fine. So I can't really know their mind and I can't know their motive. But the declared thing that I would hear from Republicans from downstate is, yes, Chicago is getting too much money and this just isn't fair.
Now, let me ask you, Mike, you know this, you've been covering SB1. Is it out of whack? Is Chicago getting more money? I mean, because a lot of this is about the pension pickup. And that, of course, is money that doesn't affect anywhere else in the state. It's $300 million, something like that.
Well,
I mean, is it out of whack? Is it disproportionate that Chicago gets more money than the rest of the state?
You know, what Governor Rauner has been calling it is a Chicago bailout. And rather than inject my own opinion into this, PolitiFact, the organization that researches these sort of statements and then determines whether or not they're actually true or not, has stated yesterday that they found that it is not a bailout for the city of Chicago, that it would be a proportionable amount of money for the city of Chicago, and Chicago Public Schools should receive that amount of money. Now, putting it on a whole other component here, though, which is that this Chicago Public Schools are in a raging financial disaster. I mean, if they don't get the money from SB1, Chicago Public Schools are essentially going to have a $1 billion operational deficit for this year. If they do get the money from SB1, they're still going to have like a $500-600 million operational deficit that they're going to have to fix. And when you go and talk to legislators outside of Chicago and you say, hey, did you know about this? Did you know that these numbers were so big? Generally, the answer was, no, I didn't know that. But, you know, they should be able to fix it by taking care of their TIFs. I mean, you know, they have all these ideas about how it's supposed to be fixed, but they don't really comprehend that the magnitude of the problem is so big, it's not going to be just one little quick fix.
What's lost in all of this, and I guess it does come down to what you just said, what's lost is that running a deficit of $1 billion, at a certain point, when we've seen it in the last 2 or 3 years, there has been turmoil after turmoil when it comes to teachers' pensions and their contract, to resources that are allocated to the schools, to the actual amount of staff and you know, people that are paid for at CPS, and all the while, less and less interest in the actual kids' education. And I'm not trying to be a do-gooder that's like, they need to get this done.
Right.
But it seems to me that there's a feel in Springfield that's like, let them die.
Right.
And I guess at the end of the day, no one thinks that, yes, there has definitely, and I'm not advocating whatsoever to say that there never was mismanagement. There is mismanagement out the wazoo.
Yeah.
From mayors, from CPS administrators
for a long time.
But I guess the question I have from a political standpoint is, yes, let's declare there to be a mismanaged history. Let's fix it and let's move forward. Because the idea of punishing someone politically for that mismanagement doesn't work when at the end of the day, we're talking about education.
One of the things that's interesting to me is, you know, as I was running around the Capitol, I didn't really see anybody from CPS. You know, maybe they were on the phones, but there was no presence. You know, I didn't see the kind of presence that I would expect on something like this that's so important for the city of Chicago and for Chicago Public Schools. I think that the amount of communication coming from the city to legislators around the state, really to make their case, you know, this is something that we're having a, let's call it a humanitarian crisis and we need your help, I don't think has really been done.
And is that have to do with a broken political system where the only people that matter are the leaders, the speaker and the Senate president? Why do they have to go advocate against the Senate?
That it's really not true. I mean, one of the things that's really interesting about the budget was that the budget passed essentially because the rank and file members were like, this is garbage. We're actually going to start negotiating something. And it happened under the leader's feet. One of the first things that the new Senate Republican leader, Bill Brady, had said when he met with the caucus in Springfield, the Republican Senate Republican caucus, was, don't cut any deals, rank and file. Let me negotiate it for you, because if you start going and cutting deals, it's going to cut me out from underneath. And Jim Durkin, the Senate or the House Republican leader, did the same thing. You know, the, I think that there is
essentially, and I don't want to make that, it's a delicious irony that it's collective bargaining, but go ahead.
But I mean, I think that the there is definitely a feeling among the rank and file that they want to get something done, and they're frustrated with this process.
Now, to hear Girvin Arounder today on Roe's show, he said, you know, this was Madigan is really great at making people cave. That the Republican lawmakers, he forced them to cave. I mean, he used language in the interview that was sort of throwing those Republican lawmakers who did vote for the budget under the bus, saying they Madigan did this. Madigan is a dangerous politician. He doesn't do what's good for the state, and he forced Republicans to cave.
I think that there is, I don't maybe so, but I think that there is a tremendous amount of pressure on Republican legislators back home. You know, there are all these school superintendents that have been coming out in favor of SB 1. The organizations that are the education, pro-education organizations that are outside of Chicago, the most that they would say, you know, from the suburbs and downstate, the most that they would say is, let's just deal with SB 1. Don't veto it. You know, let's just do something
with
it.
On it.
You know, let's negotiate over it. So I think that really where we're going to end up with SB 1 and education funding is that the fight is going to be about how much money is Chicago going to get and what are some of the other things that can be put into the process for other stuff. And one of the things that we keep hearing a lot about, and Ray Hodge, our reporter, is doing some great reporting on this in Springfield. One of the things that we keep hearing is that vouchers is really going to be the big story. And is there going to be some sort of thing that's going to be inserted into this language that's going to help charter schools and private schools?
I mentioned it yesterday. I don't know how. I mean, we make Jeff Sessions recuse himself over Russia. How do you not recuse the governor when you talk about, you know, CPS
vouchers,
and his interest in charter schools?
Right.
And he's got a
one
named after
him.
Yeah,
he has a big interest in charter schools.
Mike Fouché from the Daily Line in studio with us. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. Talk about 2018. It's August.
Woo!
It's August 2017. It's finally here. This is the traditional month for the beginning of the 2018 gubernatorial campaign.
Of the politics. It's here.
We've been talking
about it for like 6 months. And
yeah,
now it's finally
all that
here.
Doesn't matter. It starts now.
Now.
Stay with us. There's that gritty.
It's time for the bummer music.
Yeah, and that's not bummer music. It's gritty Chicago. It's got a electric blues kind of style. Mike Fouché in the Daily Line.
Yeah.
This should be a theme song for Rick Kogan right here. Right? It's Rick Kogan. It's perfect. Mike 630 says, I don't know exactly how old you are, but Chicago, for as long as I've been alive, always gets more than their fair share of everything because the legislature seems to believe that Illinois stops at the border of Cook County. Here we go again, talking about the idea that Chicago gets more than its fair share. It's disproportionate. It's been forever.
So I'm 44, you know. I'm kind of old,
long
but not
tooth.
Really. And one of the things that's important to recognize is that Chicago is a net tax supplier to the rest of the state, and followed by DuPage and Lake Counties, but DuPage and Lake Counties are far behind Chicago. So, you know, when you're really thinking about is Chicago taking its fair share, you could look at it from the perspective of, well, how much money does Chicago generate for the rest of the state? A lot of the programs are paid for by Chicago. And if you look at it equitably, according to PolitiFact, not me, this organization of people that research this sort of thing, what they found is that SB 1 is actually equitable and not getting disproportionate.
Is this an argument, though, and you know, thanks for your text, 630, but this is an argument that's not just in the state of Illinois. It goes to any big state with big cities. I mean, there's always been an argument between what the city gets and what the rest of the state gets.
I mean, you know, I haven't always been a reporter. I used to be a political consultant. I used to work in politics. I've worked in Massachusetts, Virginia, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, California. And in all of those places, there's always a big city versus the rest of the state argument. And in every single state, everyone outside of the big cities hate the big cities. And they think the big cities dominate everything and run everything. Mm-hmm. And the people in the big cities think that the people outside of the big cities are a huge drag and a pain in the butt. I mean, that's the long and the short of it.
I mean, and you're right, 630. I've lived here long enough for those stories to come out where lawmakers down in Springfield put in a bill that says, let's have a let's have a state that doesn't include Chicago. I mean, Chicago be its own state. I mean, we've had this argument forever.
This city-state thing actually is going on a lot all over the country. Texas recently passed a bill that limits development in the cities. The state legislature is largely red and Republican-controlled, whereas most of the cities in Texas are very, very blue. And the legislature felt like the cities were taking too much control of development and zoning, so they passed legislation to limit the abilities of cities to be able to do that. In Nashville, there was a very popular light rail line that was going to be passed, but it needed state money. And the state legislature said, no, 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 we are not interested in rail. We should really be putting our money into roads. But in a big city, you want rail because that's density. And they killed the rail in Nashville. In Florida, Florida actually has the third highest Amtrak ridership in the country, I think, after New York, Illinois, and California, maybe the fourth. And they were going to build a high-speed rail line in Florida, very, very popular in the cities in Florida. But that was killed by the state legislature because,
so
again,
so this is not a state of Illinois issue.
No, this is everywhere. And I think that all over the country, there's this real kind of real struggle between suburban, rural versus city.
All right, let's transition quickly as we wrap up tonight to the 2018 gubernatorial race. As
yeah,
we said, August is when it traditionally kicks off with a couple of days at the Illinois State Fair.
Right. Yeah.
Governor's Day, Democrats Day.
You go get your pork chop on a stick.
And you listen
and then
to
you
politicians.
Go listen to politicians.
Now, this year's going to be different. They're actually not doing Democrats Day? What is this?
Yeah. There's going to be
Republican. That ruins my whole month.
There's going to be Governor's Day on the 16th and then Democrats Day on the 17th. It flips, you know, whoever has the party. And the Republicans are all about it. They're still going to do it. And they're also going to have the governor's barbecue, which is going to be really fun. But the other thing that the Democrats do is that they have a big production where they have a big Democratic chairman's brunch.
They do
so all the county
hotel,
chairs
right,
get
right,
together and,
right.
you know, and they have it at the
right. Speakers,
I don't know, whatever hotel
and people
is.
Come in,
and
yeah.
this year it's Senator Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota that's going to speak. And the thing is that there's also a lot of speeches from all of the leading Democrat lights. So Madigan gives a speech and the comptroller gives a speech and the treasurer will give a speech and, you know, all those people. And the thing, and also Secretary of State will give a speech. The thing is that if you go to this stuff, you have the brunch and there are the speeches at the brunch. And then you go over to that part of the fairgrounds.
It's the same thing again.
It's a part of the fairgrounds. It's kind of stuck in the back. You know, nobody really cares. It's nowhere near the racetrack or any of the fun stuff. And then, you know, there's the same speeches, but it's hot. And you're sitting in these folding chairs. And then afterwards, they serve beer. And so everybody drinks the beer. And it's kind of nice if you're one of the Democrats or Republicans, because then you get to talk to all the other people in the party. And you're probably getting ready to run a primary campaign. So you can go meet the campaign manager from the primary campaign. And, you know, you look them in the eyes and say, I'm going to kill
But they're
you.
Not doing it. They're not going to do the Democrats.
They're not doing it. And they're not doing it because everyone hates it. I mean, it's a huge pain in the butt. Well, I mean, the last couple of years that they've had it, you know, everyone spends all of their time and energy on the brunch, which is inside.
Yeah, and then they get there.
You know, you got food. And then you go to the thing at the state fair, and nobody really wants to go. You hear the same speeches all over again. It's a bummer.
All right, so we've been kind of joking around on the program in this segment about how early the gubernatorial race began. A lot of people threw their hat in months ago.
Right.
As we get to the actual day, that's the Illinois
petitions,
State Fair.
Petitions go out at the end of this month. You go on the ballot.
The Illinois State Fair usually is where you'll start to see the candidates emerge at the beginning. As we start the month of August, where are we? I mean, is J.B. Pritzker the front runner in the Democrats, or polls suggest that Chris Kennedy actually has a lead? Is Bruce Rauner running? And he's on road today saying, I'll make that decision a little
running.
Bit earlier.
Yeah. He's running. He put $40 million in his account. You know, he wrote personal check.
Yeah, I don't know what that money's for.
That's like payment on an aircraft carrier interest, you know, or something like that. I don't know. So he, you know, definitely J.B. Pritzker and Chris Kennedy and Maya Pawar and Daniel Biss. And there's some other people that are out there. You know, it's a real question about, you know, what's going to happen. I think that we'll probably get to sometime around December and then somebody will drop out. We'll begin to see people dropping out. Exactly who. Who knows? You know, I think J.B. Pritzker has plenty of money and he wants to go all the way to the end. His numbers are good enough, I think, at this point that if they stay at this point, he'll go all the way at least to the primary. And the question is, you know, which of the other three, Kennedy, Biss, or Pouar, are going to hang on? I think Pouar keeps hoping that he's going to catch fire with some kind of Bernie Sanders-like kind of thing.
There's been a movement to that the fact that there are no women running this time around. Any chance that a female candidate jumps in the race at some point based
Maybe.
On this?
Maybe. I mean, I doubt it. I mean, I think that really a lot of the assets for having people that to run campaigns and things like that, I mean,
they've all been gobbled up.
They've all been gobbled up. You got to find somebody to be your campaign manager, to run field, to do your press in order to do your mail, do your TV, and do your polling. And that's hard to find. Yeah. So
a lot of people out in the Trump administration. I'm just saying.
Yeah, right. Why not just Scaramucci would be a great campaign manager. He'd be awesome.
Mike Fouché from The Daily Line joins us every Wednesday. His podcast comes out here at WGN Plus Aldercast on Fridays. Mike, great to talk to you. Thanks for coming in.
Great to be here.
Thanks, Rob. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour tonight, Scott Spencer is going to be here, longtime novelist, two-time National Book Award finalist. His new novel, River Under the Road, is out, and he will be at Bookends and Beginnings in Evanston tomorrow night for a reading. So Scott Spencer in studio, one of the great novelists of our time. Upstate New York right now, but was born on the south side of Chicago, so Scott Spencer will be my guest coming up in the 9 o'clock hour tonight. Well, coming up on August 7th, the Chicago Culinary World will come together for the annual Lemon Chicago event at the Revel Space on Fulton. It's an event showcasing some of the best chefs and food from all around the country, with all the proceeds going to fight childhood cancer. The event has been going on since 2014, and it's raised over $700,000. The event will feature chefs like Sarah Grunberg from Monteverde, Jason Hamill from Lula Cafe, Stephanie Eisen from Girl and the Goat, and so many more. And like I said, not just from Chicago, but from all around the country. The hosts of the event are Chef Tony Montuano from Spiaggia and two of my next guests from One Off Hospitality, Donnie Medea and Chef Paul Kahn. Both are behind some of the Chicago's greatest restaurants, from Publican to Avec to Big Star, Nico Osteria, Blackbird, the latest Publican anchor. I mean, the list is so damn impressive. It really is.
So damn impressive.
So damn impressive. The James Beard Award. The James Beard Award-winning chef and restaurateur of One Off Hospitality are my guests tonight at the big table. Paul Kahn, Donnie Medea. Welcome to The Download. Good to see you guys.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
So let's talk about Lemon Chicago, because this is something that's been going on since 2014, and it's an event that brings the chefs together in a tasting room. And Revel, we had the guys from Revel on not too long ago in our business segment. Talk about where this comes from, the idea of giving back to cancer research.
Yeah, I just want to mention one thing. $700,000 only in Chicago in the past 3 years, but $15 million in the peripheral, meaning that this event was created back in Philly back in 2001, 2002, I think, when Mark Vetri took it upon himself with his business partners to create this incredible... Liz and Jay Scott... the mother and father of Alex, which this charity is named after, they joined forces together. Their first year they did it outside of Osteria on Broad Street in 2001 or 2002. Paul attended. I came the following year. They did $150,000. In the last 3 years, they clocked in $1 million at the Urban Outfitters
headquarters,
which is the old Navy Yards in Philly.
So it's amazing. I mean, this is a nationwide event that continues to bring in money for, I mean, what I call a generic, I mean, when I say childhood cancer, that's a generic term for really for research and development for all sorts of cancers and things that affect children.
Yeah, you know, what Donnie said about the event starting in Philly is true, and they started, I think they invite 50 chefs from all over the country and all over the world, a bunch of guys coming from Italy, friends of Mark, and it's an amazing event, and it was so inspirational to a lot of the chefs that attended it that they took it upon themselves to do it in their own cities. So Suzanne Gowen does it, from Luke does it in L.A., Jonathan Waxman did it for a while in New York, and on and on and on. So it's an incredible cause. I think the real key thing here is, there's a lot of great charities out there. A lot of money is raised, and a lot of them are real top-heavy. Alex's lemonade stand an incredible charity because so much of the money goes directly to research and directly affects children's lives. It saves a lot of kids, which I think is a pretty incredible thing.
Well, why do you guys get involved? I mean, in Chicago, you've donated your talents to Philly. You talked about it right mm-hmm. at the beginning, Donnie. I mean, what is it about starting and doing your own mm-hmm. event in Chicago?
Yeah, I think you get behind the movement. You know, what you see, what Mark does and his business partner, Jeff Michaud and Jeff Benjamin, they're in it to win it, and they really feel the movement. So like Jonathan Waxman and Nancy Silverton in L.A. and Susan Goyne, we felt the movement. And instead of just going there once a year and participating for this one-day event, we felt compelled that the charity was so near and dear to our hearts after the last 10, 12 years of being involved with it, that we wanted to bring it to Chicago and we wanted to participate. Go ahead, keep going.
And I'll say that when we...
I'm fast, by the way.
When we were opening Blackbird almost 20 years ago, yeah. 21 years ago, because we had no idea what we were doing. We were just kind of doing it with our own hands and scurrying around and trying to figure out how to pay for everything. One of the things that we really... one of the early discussions we had was... How are we going to be different? How are we going to give back to the community? And, you know, those are the guiding principles of our restaurant group, One of Hospitality. It's not good enough to run a great restaurant and make people happy. I mean, that's crucial. That's important. Yeah. Hospitality is amazing. But, you know, the restaurant business uses so many resources, uses more energy than just about anything. It creates more garbage than just about anything. And we said from the very beginning that we want to treat our employees, our farmers, everyone that's involved in our business with a great deal of dignity and respect. And I think that lesson has taken us really far. And we've never missed a payment on any bills. We're very proud of the level of dignity that we conduct ourselves mm-hmm. with. And so when we saw this charity and this event and how amazing it was, like Donnie said, we got swept into the movement, and they're amazing people. The story is amazing. And it's an incredible cause.
Putting on an event like this, I mean, to have chefs from all 30 plus chefs coming in from all over the country to do it in a space like this, to do it in tasting style where people come through, it's a lot of work. It's one thing to say that One-Off Hospitality wants to give back and give mm-hmm. to charity. But to do it this way, in which you are putting together an event on top of the restaurants I mentioned, which was half the fleet. I mean, where do you guys find the time for this? I mean, the idea of putting this together.
We don't. I'm going to say one word. Heather Medina.
Heather Medina, our assistant, is the last 2 weeks with, of course, Rachel to our right. The thread of emails and orchestration and execution, she
takes it all on.
She takes it all on. Flights, arrangements, cars, where the food will be brought.
She's filling
gift
bags right now.
flowers. It's true. Every little detail. And to be honest with you, if it wasn't for Heather, there's absolutely no way that either Paul and I could pull this off. And we're also, you know, we also have, you know, our great team. Our business partners are going to pull in and they're going to help out and they're going to load ice and they're going to polish glassware and they're going to do whatever it takes. But it takes an army. It really does.
It really does, right?
And where do we find the time? Well, Justin, we have no time. There is no
you
time.
Don't need it anymore,
I just
right?
I just had a 45-minute break with my wife. She's sitting waiting for me at Nico. I brought you a little pasta, so hopefully you'll enjoy it. And
nice.
And I'll
job,
go back
Donnie.
There and
she's waiting. I hope you told her that you were coming to do the interview. You're like, I'll be right back.
I'll
I just
right
need to check
back.
Something in the kitchen. You go out the back door into a cab, come over.
What pasta did you bring?
Rigatoni, because I want to make sure
it'll hold up well.
Good.
It'll
Thank
hold up
you.
Well, and there's a nice piece of focaccia in there as well.
Thank you. For an event like this, both of you guys have been involved in a lot of different tasting events. And when we talk tasting events, it's 30 different stations in mm-hmm. which people, they pay one ticket and they come through and they can sample a different.
Yeah.
But there's a lot that goes into that because, you know, you guys both have been at whether it be James Beard Receptions or Chicago Gourmet or other
Tons.
Places. I mean, what I hear over and over is, I mean, the infrastructure and the design of those things have to be on point. You know, I talked to so many different chefs who have said, I'm glad that I got involved with this, but when I get here, I mean, it is tough. It's tough work to have the stuff come out, and there's not a lot of time for chit-chat and schmoozing and all that kind of stuff. for you guys, from being a part of that and understanding it, do you put input into how this should be the right kind of event, a more one-off hospitality kind of event?
We certainly do. But one thing I'll mention, you know, the group of chefs from Chicago and from all around the country are total pros. You know, Donald Link from New Orleans, one of the greatest chefs in New Orleans. Michael Shamrusky, I think he's the greatest seafood chef in America. That's just my humble opinion. These guys do a ton of events, and they come ready to roll. They come with, you know, boxes the size of a coffin full of food, most of it prepped. If they need anything, they reach out to us. We get that for them. And so they come in, and there's very little for them to do. Almost all the prep is done in the comfort of their own kitchens. Mm-hmm. And same with the Chicago guys, the Chicago men and women. They bring it. They're ready to go. You know, we provide everything that they ask for, and we go. You know, an interesting thing is the last 2 years we did this event, it was actually at the Modern Wing of the Art Institute, and it was a different format.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Each chef did a table, a four-course meal for a table of 10 people. And then we had a dessert buffet from a lot of great pastry chefs after that. And we changed this because we wanted it to be a little more fun, a little more laid back. And I think for us, the real focus is on some amazing auction items that we're going to offer. That's really where the bread and butter comes from and where the charity raises the money. Mm-hmm. So we put a lot of time and effort into those auction items, not getting off the course of how difficult it is to pull this off, but we have an incredible team that's been on there.
I was going to say, I mean, there is something to be said about this format, the format you're shifting to.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a format that now is seems to be the go-to for a lot of different charities where chefs will come in for they'll set up their stations and the people pay one ticket to come in and sample the food. I mean, really you're seeing more and more of those kind of pop up to get a sample of some of the great celebrity chefs that are in the city and beyond.
Yeah, that Dine Around. The first time I saw that was with Paul early on at Alex's in Philly, and they do it so well, and Susan adopted that as well. And it's just like Paul said, the word fun is a major component, because you don't have one chef cooking specifically for 10 or 12 people. You have 30 chefs cooking for everyone. So if you want to eat 30 bites, or if you want to eat 10 bites, your 10 favorite bites. And then again, I use this movement. The movement goes around like, who's the best? Well, Jeremy, Charles, his dish is incredible. And then it'll get around, well, so-and-so's dish is incredible. And people will come to the chefs and goes, listen, I've been in every station. Your dish is the best. And usually it's Paul's.
Thanks, Donnie. And you know, Donnie mentioned Jeremy Charles. He is from St. John's, Newfoundland. There was just an amazing article in the New York Times last weekend about him and the great chefs in St. John's. I went out there and cooked with Jeremy a few years ago. You are on the – it's a three-hour or three-and-a-half-hour flight from St. John's, Newfoundland to London. It's in North America, which is crazy. It's a really beautiful place, but most of all, he's an amazing chef. He just gets some incredible ingredients from farmers, fishermen, hunters, things like that out there. So there's a real impressive group of
chefs.
It's
amazing to look at the list of people that will be at the event. Lemon Chicago, which will be on August 7th at the Revel Fulton Market space. We just had the Revel people in. That's the space at Fulton and Racine. Chef Paul Kahn, Donnie Medea in studio tonight, the guys behind One Off Hospitality. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll continue our conversation here at the Big Table. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, my guest at the Big Table tonight, the guys behind One Off Hospitality, the restaurant group that brings us Publican Anchor, Avec, Blackbird. I don't know why I named these. I don't know why I named any of these. It's ridiculous how much. I mean, you guys, Donnie Medea, Chef Paul Kahn in studio tonight. We're talking about the event Lemon Chicago, which will be on August 7th at Revel Fulton Market. It's a tasting. What do you call it? A tasting forum or what?
Dine around.
Feeding frenzy with some of the biggest chefs, not only here in Chicago but all around the country, around the world. It'll be at Revel, and it'll be. All proceeds going to fight childhood cancer. You know, for you guys, I mean, I kind of joke about, you know, the empire that you've made, like the idea that I name these restaurants and I just stop in the middle of it. But it is really impressive. You talked about opening Blackbird together 21 years ago. Take us back to Blackbird. Mm-hmm. You know, for you guys to get into the Chicago restaurant business with a fine dining restaurant establishment, where were you guys at? Talk about that experience, about bringing Blackbird to Chicago.
Where were we at? I was bartending. Our other business partner, Ricky, he was bartending. Our other business partner, Edward, was waiting tables, and Paul was, he was cooking at Irwin's, and I think we all knew it about one another, and we came together to do something different and special in an area that wasn't developed yet. We had a great architect, even though we didn't know what the place would look like at the end of the architectural format. But it was, the process was fun because we had time. We don't have time now, but we had time.
It was the good old days.
We had time to sweep. We had time to get in our car and drive to find items that we needed to get deals on in order to do the right finishes. That
yank
the,
stuff on old hotels. Yeah. We did whatever was necessary.
Yank, exactly.
We were animals.
I don't know about the animals, but we were very ambitious. Not that we're not ambitious now, but we were ambitious in different ways because we knew that it was do or die. We sunk every dime or penny that our families, our aunt or uncle or friend would give us, and we were able to pull this off at the 11th hour. It took us 15 months to build it. We did everything that we could with our hands to build this restaurant, and it was fun. It was, there was a lot of camaraderie. There was a lot of stress. There was a lot of think tanks. How are we going to get through this week? We need payroll. Our general contractor at the time, he went missing a few times. We had to fire him.
He was living in the space. It was a real grassroots.
Well, I mean, that's 1996 we're talking about? 1995, yeah. 1996?
We signed the lease in 96. We started building in September. We signed the lease in September of 96. We finished in December. We opened December of 97, so it took us 15 months. It
took you 15 months. So this is really the 20th anniversary this year.
Yeah,
I'm fascinated in what Chicago's culinary scene was like then. I mean, I remember it, but I mean, it was a dominated, let us entertain you kind of.
Yeah, I was going to go there. There was very few independents. I think the most notable, of course, is Rick Bayless. Frontier Grill was open. They just celebrated their 30th anniversary, and Rick's a mentor. I spent a number of years working at Frontier in Topolo Bampo. But beyond that, there was Gordon Sinclair. There wasn't really much beyond that, and there was really nothing that was, I mean, Frontera was not fine dining. It was raucous, crazy. It was before you opened Topolo Bampo. And we wanted to do a place that had a lot of energy but sort of brought in all the elements of fine dining. You know, I had gone to France and dined around, and I was just, obsessed with all the, all the fun things that you get in a meal like that without the stuffiness. And, you know, the space... because of Donnie's relationship with Thomas Schlesser, the architect, who's a brilliant guy, the space was built, and we're like, holy cow, what did we get ourselves into? And the space really created bigger britches to fill. You know, it's very sleek. I think it's timeless. I mean, there's so much...
No, it still stands. I mean, it's still the same building. Still,
it's, you know, yeah. People come in and they say, this space is so fresh. It's so incredible. And you say, well, it's been here 20 years, and they've like, how many times have you remodeled? Mm-hmm. And we say, none.
That's amazing.
And that in and of itself is amazing. And
it's also amazing because, you know, you were one of the first restaurants in Chicago to open up in that West Loop area. I mean, you're right there on the other side of the expressway. But the idea of combining fine dining experience with design,
mm-hmm.
And also doing something, as you mentioned, in an entrepreneurial spirit. There weren't a lot in front of you guys. I mean, there were chains and other things that were happening and a lot of groups that were putting things together. But the idea, it didn't seem at the time that there was a true independent spirit in the culinary scene here in Chicago. Did you recognize it at that time? Were you like, we're doing something. We kind of want to be trailblazers. We're gonna do this our way.
I think we were trailblazers. I mean, we knew we had to because we couldn't afford the rent on the west side of Halsted, where Jerry Kleiner was.
Oh, right.
And Vivo was there, and then Marché opened in 93, and then he opened a place called Red Light. So he was like the king of Restaurant Row, the original Restaurant Row. And we looked at all those spaces, but we didn't feel comfortable spending the amount of money on that side. So we went on the other side, and you know, everybody laughed at us like, are you out of your mind? You're on a one-way street? What, are you crazy? You got to be with everyone else. And lo and behold, when you think about it, when people thought we were crazy, we did trailblaze because those that one-way street was an avenue for people exiting the city going back home.
They're going to the expressway, right?
Tens of thousands of cars would drive by and look at that fishbowl and go, what is that place? I want to go in there. And they didn't make it to the west side because on the other side of Halsted, because they got on either going north or south and went home. So we had an opportunity to all these people that became voyeurs to this little restaurant, and they came and checked us out. And, you know, was it luck? Was it trailblazing? Were we idiots?
All three
of those.
Was the original plan with the business partners and you guys to open multiple restaurants, or was it just we're going to do Blackbird?
You know, we just one at a time. I don't think we even had a plan. I don't think we knew what the hell we were doing. We were just had a lot of grit and a lot of drive, and I think we really wanted to be successful. For me, you know, the way that I was taught to cook wasn't really out there, you know, and finding incredible products and a real passion for farmers. You know, now everything is local and everything is, you know, everyone shops the farmers market. You know, everyone talked that talk back then, but no one did it. There was a couple guys that went to the farmers market, and we would always see each other there. And for me, from the very beginning, you know, we had farmers come in our back door. You know, again, from my mentors, from Erwin Dreschler and from Rick Bayless, they were guys that were doing that long before. And, you know, my obsession with Alice Waters and Chez Panisse was kind of what built the food of that restaurant. And I think when we saw that restaurant got to be fancy, you know, or a little fancier than I had planned.
And clean,
you know. And so the design really influenced the food.
And that's important.
We didn't know what the heck we were doing.
Paul Kahn, Donnie Medea in studio tonight. We're talking about the, of course, one-off hospitality, but also the event coming up on August 7th, which will be at the Revel Space on Fulton here in Chicago, an event that will bring in celebrity chefs from all around the country, around the world. To an event that goes, it's an annual event. All the proceeds go to fight childhood cancer. All right, we'll do this. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll get the news, and we'll continue our conversation after the news with Donnie and Chef Paul Kahn in studio. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman in studio tonight at the big table. Chef Paul Kahn, restaurateur Donnie Medea, the guys behind One Off Hospitality, the great restaurant group here in Chicago, the Deans. As I say, the Deans. That's, you guys have turned into the Deans of the restaurant scene here in Chicago. They're also hosting a tremendous event on August 7th at the Revel Space on Fulton Racine, called Lemon Chicago, that brings in 30 plus chefs from around the country, around the world, to bring their talents for childhood cancer. This is something they've been doing for a couple of years. A big event. Tickets are available, so check it out. You know, as I gave you guys in studio, it's interesting because I've had a lot of chefs that come through. We do a segment called Industry Night where we continue to talk about the food and hospitality industry here in Chicago, and it's night and day. Since the last time we talked, Donnie, I mean, we talked 2 years ago.
Yep.
And even in 2 years' time, this area around Michigan Avenue, other neighborhoods, I mean, more and more restaurants are coming to Chicago. More and more restaurant groups that aren't from Chicago are setting up shop here. You know, why do you see the growth of this scene? I mean, we were talking right before the news about 20 years ago, Blackbird, 1996. We fast forward to now, 2017. I mean, how do you see, where do you see? I mean, are we truly the mecca in this country when it comes to food?
Yeah, I think that there, I mean, Paul can comment more about his colleagues in the industry. I equate your question to a shift in independence in itself. Like Breakout 1997, like you said earlier, there wasn't that much going on. So we were compelled to do our own thing, whether it was the ability to not conform to authority, or if we wanted to not work for a big restaurant group, but let's not forget Trotter's 1996. He's a breakout guy in himself. What he did was groundbreaking. Melman, I mean, speak of him. I heard him speak this year at the Welcome Conference, 1972. I think his number is 246 restaurants.
He owns, so, wow, that's amazing.
So from 72 until now, wait, yeah. I'm sorry. 46 years, something like 100 restaurants. That's more
well,
like
math
it.
Is not a lot. Download doesn't do math.
Yeah. So anyway, I think what I was going to mention is the shift of independence. It's not what you know; it's what someone sees, and if they're in and they work with us, and they see us opening restaurant after restaurant, or they see the Boca guys opening restaurant after restaurant, or they see Melman opening restaurant after restaurant. Now his sons are opening restaurants. Mm-hmm. So I think the shift is the movement itself. And the movement means I can do that. I can get a chef. I can sign a lease. I can do my own deal. I can find funding. You know, the complexities of a restaurant is, you know, I consider myself really lucky. We're two of seven. So I have two of seven partners. And I feel very lucky that somebody's constantly watching my back. Mm-hmm. And I'm watching someone else's back. So the reason why we can open more restaurants is, well, we have the knowledge. We've had the knowledge of 20 years. But we didn't know, like Paul used an important word in the last segment, we didn't know anything about anything back then. But now when somebody's in your own fold, they feel they write things down, they take knowledge, they look at things, they ask questions, and it's a different atmosphere these days. It's I can do that.
Is it? I mean, I guess I asked this question probably knowing the answer. And I'll ask you this, Paul, but I mean, is it an easier business to get into? You know, the idea that there's more opportunity than, say, in 1996? Because the old adage used to be, you know, most restaurants aren't going to last 5 years. You have a successful restaurant if you make it to five.
You know, I think it's not easier to get into financially. I think it's a heck of a lot more difficult to get into financially. But I think it's easier because the market is just growing like crazy, and the amount of attention that chefs and restaurants get is growing like crazy. So, you know, we'll see is the answer to your question. I mean, so many places are opening. You know, longevity for us is an indicator. You know, all of our places, you know, knock on wood, they're all open. And, you know, 20 years, 12 years for a VAC.
14 years
for a VAC. And on and on and on. And so for us, it's about great food. It's about great design. Mostly it's about great hospitality. I think that's the thing. But to answer your question, is it easier? It must be. Right. I'm not exactly sure why.
Maybe the demand. Maybe because the world changed in the way that people want fine dining, or they want that experience. There's just more customer
base. We're so
much
about providing services. Yeah. You know, it's tattoo parlors, nail shops, and restaurants. That's all we got. Everything else you can get and do on the internet.
and pretty soon, restaurants on the internet, too. Yeah. All right. So, you know, it's interesting because there's two things I want to get into, which is just what that expansion, that growth of a culinary scene means for individual restaurants. I mean, obviously, there's demand. Like you said, all your restaurants are still open. But we had, you know, we had Catherine Diorio on talking from Check Please, and she said the theme from this year's season was service is bad. Mm-hmm. We've had others on and said, you know, there's a chef or there's a cook shortage. Oh, mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that there starts to be a little bit of a strain on good talent that can be used in restaurants that are selling good hospitality.
Sure.
And you guys do. I mean, Donnie, when you were in there, I remember that conversation. You talked a lot about service. Mm-hmm. Being number one, how do you maintain that quality when the growth of an industry, especially here in Chicago, just is so exponential? It's so accelerated.
Obsessive compulsive behavior. you know, it's knowing who's in your restaurants and how you can get to the guest and make sure that the guest, every guest, is having an incredible experience. And if they're not. How do you cure the bad dining experience? I can't tell you that not every one of our restaurants, maybe once in a while, will someone will have an off experience. So How do you cure that? And that's with, you know, this just being humble and calling the person or inviting them back in, or sending, you know,
whatever it takes,
sending something from PQM, a basket of goodies from PQM's, PQM. The importance has to be it has to be high level, and taking care of guests. I consider myself very lucky to have a business partner like Paul Kahn, and what he does in the kitchen and how he mentors his cooks and sous chefs and chefs about product and availability, but also about the participation. Hold on one second.
Yeah, go.
You're rolling, dude. No, but I think the level of importance is that if I consider myself lucky, what can I do in the front of the house to make the guest experience the ultimate, the best?
I can match the food that's coming out, right?
Yeah, because you're gonna win an award for a great chef, but we're not in it to win awards. What we're here to do is create an experience, full level, hospitality, service, and food, and just make people feel the best when they come into our restaurants. And I think the important part of that is teaching.
Yeah, and I'm gonna key off. Sorry to interrupt you, Donnie, I'm gonna key off on a word that Donnie mentioned: humility. I think that's such a crucial perspective for chefs, for restaurateurs, for young cooks, for everyone involved in the business. And I don't know, you know, back in the day, it was like, you don't like that food. It's the way I wanted to cook it. You get out of my restaurant.
Right.
Now it's like, you know, please tell me if you liked it. If you didn't, I'll make it differently. We'll do whatever we can to make sure you have a great experience. And I think that's something that, from the dishwasher to the host and everyone in between at our restaurants, we feel is incredibly important. And, you know, for me, man, I could promote a lot harder, and I could do a lot of things that I choose not to, because, you know, we found a niche, you know, that we really enjoy. I like to mentor young chefs, and we have a ton of them in our company. And I think that is that's how we fight the war against the lack of cooks and the lack of chefs.
Well,
we provide great opportunities.
Exactly. I mean, as you talked about your experience with Chef Bayless and others as well. You worked Irwin, and talk about what it takes. I mean, we talk about this cook shortage.
Sure.
I mean, is that a thing? It's a real thing.
Big time.
But I mean, for one-off hospitality, I would think you'd be a destination where you guys might be part of the reason why there's a cook shortage, because people want to come work with you and they don't want to work in other places.
You know, there's us and there's the Boca Group, and there's Rich Melman has a lot of great restaurants and more. There's a lot of great restaurateurs and groups and restaurants in the city, and you know, there's different groups of cooks with different ideas. You know, used to be, everyone wanted to work for us. I think a lot of cooks still do. It's a great learning experience. It's a great growth experience. There's a great opportunity to end up somewhere. You know, if you want to come in and work hard, I could tell you the story of five different people that started as a cook and are now the chef of their own restaurant
or owners
in our company. And so,
is that part of the problem, though? Is that part? I don't want to generalize generations and things like that, but is it part of the problem where you get cooks who are like, "That's my goal"?
Well, there's some short-sightedness. You know, like a young cook will work in a restaurant and be like, wow, this is really hard, and I'm only making 14 or 15 bucks an hour. I can go over there and make 18 or 19, and it's a dead end. They're, you know, 5 years from that point, they're not going to be in the business anymore. And so I think it's about long term. You know, my thing was, I have some defect in my head that says, just work hard, put your head down, learn, love what you do, and keep doing it. And I would rush back, you know, I'd rush home, look at cookbooks, rush back to the restaurant the next day to cook and try out something new that I had read about. And now it's more like young cooks want to be told exactly what to do and how you want to do it. And I'd be like, but I saw this, and what about this idea? And so the generations are a little bit different. I mean, those young men and women that still push like I did are out there, and they come along every once in a while, and it's a breath
of
fresh air.
You know, I got to say, on Friday we had Leland Sklar. He's a longtime bass player, right? He was a sessions bass player. He's been on 2,500-plus albums.
Wow.
Phil Collins, James Taylor. But he's the guy you call when you need a bass player in studio, right? And we talked about the idea. Are you the kind of bass player that comes in and you'd say, tell me what to do? You know, and he's like, no. I never play the same song twice. I never play it the same way. I'm going to change it. I'm going to add things. I'm going to do things, which is not what you think of when it comes to session. And I find a little bit it's relatable with cooks in
Absolutely.
The way that you don't necessarily want them to do it the exact same way every time. You want them to bring passion and creativity and skill, but not necessarily like a factory.
There was a huge movement. Food changed, you know, 5 or 8 or 10 years ago, and a lot more precise cooking. And it's not a bad thing. You know, great chefs like Wiley Dufresne, you know, WD-50 in New York, and Grant Atkinson. I don't know where the root of it is. Maybe it was El Bulli in Spain, but this really precise cooking happened, and I think guys that have the background and the skills can do that, and they can do it right. There's a lot of people that don't, and you can be a poser, and you can grab those tweezers and put food on the plate and put things together and puree something, but the developed flavors and the soulfulness comes from studying Italian cuisine and studying French cuisine and really getting in there and really cooking. So to put a piece of fish in a bag, cook it in a water bath, take it out, you know, sear it, put it on a plate, it may be a great piece of fish, but something's missing. And I feel like that as a whole has sort of taken a lot away from food. And there's been a backlash, you know. It's interesting. Certain cities in America cook different ways. I feel like New York is very precise and very technical, and California is sort of the opposite, you know, based on all that incredible product that they have. And believe me, that's a generalization. There are a lot in each city that cook different ways. But I just look back and I'm like, man, there's a whole generation of cooks that come to an event like we're doing with a briefcase and open it up and serve their dish. You know, I got giant boxes and coolers, and I'm sweating and working hard and actually cooking. Maybe I'm the dummy, but at the end of the day,
you're just different. I'll chime in and just mention third shift of the evening. There's also we're in a chef obsessed world because of TV. So what used to be 15 and 20 years ago, used to be the retainership of a line cook would be 2 years. I want to study under Paul. I want to study under Grant. I want to study under Tony Montuano. Our study time is 8 months now. We're lucky to have a cook for 8 months. It went from, I'll say, 2 years to a year and a half. And then it went from a year and a half to a year. Now we'll have a line cook possibly 8 months to a year.
Yeah, but I'm going to say that looking at all of our restaurants, you know, the culture in each kitchen, and the culture is dictated by the chef de cuisine. Yeah, I mentor them. I push them in a certain way. I say, no, you can't talk to that person like that. That's not the way that we do things. But the kitchens that have really strong cultures, the cooks stay for a lot longer because they know that they can contribute. They know they can learn. They can dig in. Mm-hmm. And most of all, you know, for us, our credo is let's have fun.
Yeah.
In those kitchens, they have a lot of fun. We don't take things too seriously.
Let me ask you guys this. I mean, as we get close to wrapping up here, I think of musicians and I think of artists. And over time, chefs and restaurants have turned from businesses to almost arts and culture. Presentation is a big part of it. Creativity is a big part of it. How important is, or let me ask you this way: is your job creative? Are you creative? Are you more in the arts, culture, culinary side of it than the business of running a restaurant?
Both, so equal. I think for us, you can't be creative if the business doesn't survive. But you know, for us, as our company grows, you know. The inception of an idea, going through the design process, seeing the design process come to fruition. You know, so many things that happen during the design, you know, yeah, we hire a great architect, but we push them, prod them, we inspire them. That's a big part of what we do. So it's super creative. I mean, every day I feel that we're blessed because we have the opportunity to be creative. And I think creative solutions to business, different ways to do things, different
problems,
ways to look
right,
at things,
right.
is also very important. But at the end of the day, we got nothing if we're out of business. So
yeah, right.
It's done.
Real estate deal, first and foremost. Lucky to have Paul's business partner in his creativity and in the kitchen and mentorship. But I equate a lot of the success to the real estate deal and making sure that we could afford to stay open in the leanest times and hunker down in January, February, March, where, you know, we're not in California, we're not in San Francisco, we're in the middle of the Midwest where it gets cold and it snows and people don't come out in January and February. So what do? You got to have a great real estate deal to stay open, knock on wood. And good partnerships.
It's a yin and yang. I love it. You guys, this is great. You know, are you guys fulfilled? I mean, as business partners, and you guys have had your story's been told in the way that you've done a lot of interviews, a lot of great features. I mean, looking up your work today, I mean, it's a plethora of different stories. But as you get to this point where you're coming up on the 20th anniversary of Blackbird.
Yeah, we're excited too.
I mean,
about that.
Yeah, are you? I mean, is this a fulfilling life? I mean, are you at the point where you look back on 20 years and say, I am satisfied. I am satiated. If you
I mean,
will.
The way that the
I don't
fulfillment
know about satisfied,
but. The way he's never satisfied. The way the fulfillment happens is different, and you morph along with that. I mean, I'll just mention that we're working on a project with a new partnership that we created. We're One-Off Hospitality and two wonderful chefs, Erling Wubauer, Cosmo Goss, yeah. and our great operations guy Josh Tilden, along with our other partner Terry Alexander. We've combined One-Off Hospitality with Underscore Hospitality. We'll be opening up hopefully late this year.
Yeah. Highly anticipated.
Pacific Standard Time.
Yeah.
And it's teaching those young men the creative process that we've gone through so many times, but they're teaching us so much in the process. You know, they have a different perspective on everything. And so, you know, you may scratch your head and then go, wow, that's a great idea. That's people are going to be Maybe cooks will stay longer. Maybe mm-hmm. guests will be more comfortable. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can be kinder to the planet. You know, all those things. And so, for me, that's been very fulfilling. And I see that as hopefully as the destiny of our company, continuing to empower young men and women, continuing to mentor them, continuing to grow, and continuing to push mm-hmm. our industry forward to be, you know, more sustainable, kinder and gentler to people. You know, all those things. You yeah. know, we yeah.
Donnie, what do you got?
Yeah, fulfillment. It's a tough question. It's a tough question to answer. Satisfied. Terry Alexander clipped out a. He took a clipping. He's our business partner, and an incredible businessman in his own right. He gave us all a clipping one time of a Bobby Knight quote.
He loves to clip.
satisfaction is the first sign of failure. So, am I satisfied? I don't know. I don't know what satisfied means for me personally. I know that I got to keep pushing. I got to keep the drive going.
Bobby Knight, the guy that threw all the chairs and stuff?
Yeah, one chair. He threw one chair.
He's also got a lot of great quotes.
Anyway, I think I'm satisfied in the way that we can mentor our staff and let them grow. And hopefully they'll grow with us and stay with us. But I will say, Chandra, a young lady that used to work for us, who's the editor of Plate Magazine, wrote a beautiful article about Blackbird when we turned 15 years old. And if you were to look at the lineage, would make me satisfied and make me satisfied in knowing that what we put together gave other chefs and cooks opportunities
and
to grow
and restaurateurs guys.
Yeah, to grow mm-hmm. on their own. So that's satisfying to me. It really is.
Donnie Medea and Chef Paul Kahn in studio. They are the two of the partners in One-Off Hospitality, and they are the hosts of the event coming up here on August 7th, Lemon Chicago. It's a plate food around
in memory of Alex herself, who created the lemonade stand to raise money for her own cancer research. That's the story behind it.
She raised money because she didn't want children to go what she went through.
Yeah.
So that's coming up August 7th, yep. Lemon Chicago, and it'll be 30 plus celebrity chefs
incredible
from all around the world, auction items as well. So much to of course, and you can find that stuff online. Lemon Chicago, August 7th at the Revel Fulton Market, a must attend event for Chicago foodies. Donnie Medea, Paul Kahn, appreciate you guys coming in. Great to see you again, and thanks for being my guest at the big table. Appreciate
it. Thank you for having us tonight. Thank you.
Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up to the 10 o'clock hour tonight, it's time for the swap meet. Greg Flam will be in. and we will evaluate your collectibles, your memorabilia, your junk, whatever you might have up in the attic. You think you're going to put it out in the garage sale tomorrow in the 25-cent and under bin? Maybe you want to call into the show tonight to make sure it's not a hidden gem. 312-981-7200. We do that every Wednesday night. Greg will be here. Hopefully he'll bring a new Bears poster. That's what we've been the last couple weeks. He has found one Bear poster after another of the old 85 Bears posters that were given away at Chevy dealerships and McDonald's and all that. And every time he goes to an estate sale or he goes to a different place, he collects one of them because they're so prevalent. In Chicago, of people trying to get rid of him, I guess. So we'll talk with Greg coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. Well, my next guest is a best-selling author who has penned 11 novels, his first dating back to 1973. Scott Spencer's latest is called River Under the Road. In it, two couples in New York City intertwine in a story of love, fate, art, and money. One of the couples meets right here in Chicago at a neighborhood art fair. River Under the Road is getting great reviews, and it's just the beginning of what could be a trilogy that Spencer's working on. Like I said, Scott Spencer is a critically acclaimed author of 11 novels, many that ended up being bestsellers, some of them that went on to be adapted to film. He's a two-time National Book Award finalist, and he's in town reading at Bookends and Beginnings in Evanston tomorrow night. Spencer lives in upstate New York right now, but he grew up right here on the south side of Chicago. And he is my guest tonight, Scott Spencer. Welcome to the download.
Hey, Justin. How are you?
It's great to meet you.
Great to meet you.
Great book. Thanks for coming in. I said grew up right here in the south side of Chicago. How often do you get back?
Well, my mother still lives here. So I come back maybe 3-4 times a year. Try to.
That's great.
Yeah.
So for you, I right off the bat, I mean, your book, a lot of your writing, I want to get into it, is so... eloquent. I mean, your handle of the language and the words that you use is a big part of your sort of trademark, your hallmark, if you will. But it was interesting to me as a Chicagoan that the book kind of starts off with one of the characters, Thaddeus Kaufman, who is in Chicago, and the description of where he lives, the neighborhood, the art fairs you're talking about is so dead on. That even before I knew that you grew up here in Chicago, I said, he has to be from Chicago. I mean, are you particular like that? Are you the kind of person who wants to set your novels in a place that you have been?
Yes. I wouldn't be able to write about a place without seeing it. I mean, there's not very many places. There's no places that I know as well as Chicago and New York and upstate New York. So, but I could put a scene in Los Angeles, but I've been there. I could put a scene in Slovenia, but I've been there. I couldn't just Google
Texas. Yeah, right.
I just couldn't do that. I would always feel insecure. And I feel so strongly that when you're reading something and when a detail doesn't make sense and it just falls dead, it breaks the contract between the writer and the reader. And it's very hard for the reader to get back into the book at that point.
Right.
You've sort of killed it.
As a novelist, I mean, you're not necessarily writing, you know, nonfiction. It's important for you to make sure that the reader is invested in knowing that you have experience in the place.
Exactly. It's that wonderful Marianne Moore quote, it's imaginary gardens with real toads in them.
That's great. Well, that is an interesting talk because I think that's where movie making. You think about movies and more often than not, they'll be set in Chicago and they'll say, hey, we got to get over to Main Street. You're like, that's not a street.
It
does, yeah. But there doesn't seem to be any interest in preserving that. That's something that gets thrown away in scenic design or thrown away in the script notes. It's something that's almost antithesis to what you're talking about.
Yeah, well, because they're shooting it in Toronto anyhow, so.
All right, for you, go ahead.
I don't want to pay those union.
Yeah, right. But I mean, that's funny that that's so important for a novelist, yet it somehow falls under the wayside when it comes to films. You set this book around two couples, right? For you as a writer, and there's always been this, when I think of novelists, and you know better than I, but it always seems that there's going to be a main character. There's going to be one protagonist. There's going to be someone that you follow. That seems to be the way that it's easy to sort of construct a novel in that way, and you've done that before. The idea of following four different characters, two couples, talk about that. How do you do that as a novelist to make four main characters in a book?
Well, you're right. you're completely right. It's a whole new difficulty in writing. Like several of my books have been written in the first person, so you're seeing the world through one set of eyes and one set of desires and prejudices. And when you open it up and have four people who you're following closely, it makes it much more challenging. I think that at a certain point you have to get rid of the idea that everybody has to have equal time, that it's that it has to be 25%, 25%, and just let the story go, and you concentrate on the character who is most pertinent to that part of the story. So you're not hamstrung into having to divide it into equal fourths.
I mean, for you, and you said this, that you write in first person, you have one character. Do you see this as writing, when you're writing about two couples, you can say it's either two novels, or in the case of four characters in the book, four novels. I mean, are you see it that way? Do you see it in your point that each character's story is its own novel?
It could be. And you need to approach the character like that, as if every character could be the main character and the only character. And there's things that I know about these characters that never make it into the book. Their backstories, their childhoods, just all kind of their dream life, all the stuff that I think about and sometimes I even write, but that doesn't really find a way into the final manuscript. So they all have to be important. You don't want stick figures. Right. You don't want them just there for narrative convenience. You can't expect the reader to care more about your characters than you do.
But in a lot of times, and you'll have one character and a lot of ancillary characters or supporting characters in that case.
Yes, and I do have ancillary characters.
Right.
I mean, they can't all be the star of the show. But this story for me was very much about the differences in the lives of those four people and the conflict that was sort of unspoken between them, that was kind of implied between them, and that slowly boils up to the surface. So I needed all four of them to tell the story I wanted.
It's kind of this is a very interesting book, and you write it in a way that really sort of circles around 13 parties, right? The idea of each one in there and their how these parties in different ways and vastly different affect both of the couples that are involved, not just alone, but together and the way they interact.
Right.
Talk about telling a story in that way around events, around the idea of 13 specific events.
Well, I knew I wanted to cover about 15 years in this story. And some of it is just knowing what I can do and what I can't do as a writer. And as a writer, I am better when I'm working close up and close in and with a lot of psychological and physical detail that you can't do if you're trying to sweep your story along for 15 years.
Right.
So I was trying to figure out a way that I could write the way I like to write and tell a story that was actually had more time scope than any story I've ever told before. And then at a certain point, I came up with the idea that I would just have parties and you would see them at parties and you would run into them the way you run into people you know. And, oh, my God, you know, I haven't seen you since the last Easter party or the last New Year's Eve.
It's a great device to have time elapse.
Yeah. And you don't have to account for it. It's implied. And that's kind of what I meant by River Under the Road. That's all that time and history that passes beneath our feet without our always even being aware of it.
You know, it's so interesting because, you know, I was listening to you talking to Terry Gross in Fresh Air, and you've had a long history as a writer of really diving into that fine line between sort of a regular normal life and chaos. And there's a great line that you say, I'm interested in how close our orderly lives are to chaos.
Yeah.
What draws you to that razor thin line that we all in our lives, we all know it. And we all know where, you know, everything is buttoned up and we're ready to go. And the next day everything falls apart. What is it as a writer that draws you there to write fiction?
Well, I don't know. I find that as a person, I find that exciting and shocking and scary and true. And I think that there's something about things that are staid and that feel secure that feel untruthful to me. And I'm not interested in them particularly. I'm interested in when things fall apart. And I'm interested in people when they have to react to their lives being overturned in some way.
Does that become part of, I mean, just a necessary writing tool for you in a character arc? I mean, you're always sort of developing characters, as you mentioned, like getting into their backstory and who they are and all the things you do to construct a character. Do you create this, both sides of that? Do you create the idea of their regular life and the life that they live? And do you also create the moments in which they and how they react when they fall apart?
Well, I work back and forth. I mean, because I work in drafts, and by the time I send my book to my publisher, I've written it at least four times. Mm. And so each time I know more and more about the characters, and I don't really work with a plan in mind. I just have a feeling of these characters and of a situation, and then I just start to write to see if something can happen.
But I mean, I think about characters and how it relates to our real lives, but a lot of the personality and the character that's in us is defined on how we react.
Yes.
When we cross over those lines.
Yeah. Well, it's one of the advantages of getting older as a novelist anyhow. I mean, we can talk some other time about the disadvantages of getting older. But I took my Advil, so my knee, it doesn't really hurt me that much. But you get to see firsthand, not only in your own life, but in the people you care about, how the consequences of their acts add up and catch up with them, and how they deal with it. You see the hilarious drunken friend at 30 is a much different man at 45.
Yeah, right.
And the guy who doesn't ever seem to be able to settle on a career, but just is so brilliant and inspiring, is a different man when he's 45 or 55. And you get to see the arc of people's lives in a much more realistic way.
It's staying on age. You know, for you to be on your 11th novel, your first in 1973, does age help you, does experience help you as a novelist? I mean, there are advantages to it. And I would also want to push back on something you said a little bit earlier in the convo about there are some things you know as a writer that you're good at and some things you don't. Do you have to revisit that as you get older with experience, that maybe you are better at some of the things you thought you were bad at? Do you have to push yourself?
I do have to push myself. You're absolutely right about that, because I always thought that I could never write a party scene and avoided them like the plague.
And this book.
And then I said, well, wait a second. What have I signed up for here? But I'm not to say that this book came easily.
Right.
I realized writing a party scene, I didn't like have to be the host of the party and make sure that everybody's drink was filled. But there's such a long time to write a book that if I don't feel like I'm learning something new and doing something different from what I've done before, I feel a little restless. So I do always try to do something in the writing that pushes me in some way. I want to feel like I'm growing still. But you do feel that you understand things more as an older writer. I mean, when I wrote my first book, I could say the word divorce, but I didn't really know what that meant.
Right, without meaning, right.
Yeah.
Scott Spencer in studio with me tonight, the critically acclaimed novelist, his book River Under the Road. He's going to be at Bookends and Beginnings in Evanston tomorrow night with a reading with Christine Sneed, who's been on the program as well. You know, I'm fascinated. I mean, this is a great conversation just about writing and life in general and experience. you know, for you, you've had the experience as a novelist where you've had huge success. I mean, some of your books have been are must reads that are on the, you know, the classics. And you've had experiences where those have been adapted to films. You've also dabbled a bit in your own screenwriting. But you've also been an outspoken critic in times of how your book has turned into movies. We won't get into specifics, but you've been someone who has said that this is not how it's supposed to be. You know, talk about your relationship with your work after it's done and the fact that now we're seeing more and more novelists, you know, they're writing books to get option, to become films, to do other things, to...
Well, mostly to become TV.
To become TV, right.
Yeah,
I mean, but you've been through that. You've done that. I mean, like I said, 11 novels, 1973. What's the advice you give to other writers who want to get into that business, who wanted to turn their writing over for the paycheck, you know, and get into the world of I guess, which would be options and adapting?
You know, it doesn't matter if you want to or not. It doesn't. That's not what causes it to happen, is what I believe. I mean, they'll find you if they want it, and they'll make an offer if they want to do it. Do I say don't do that? It's going to break your heart. It's going to ruin your life, your reputation. You won't be able to sleep at night. I mean, there's no question that. I mean, I wrote a novel called Endless Love in 1979. Yeah, it's been made into a movie twice. Each one, you know, rather worse than the one before. I mean, I hope this is the end of it. I mean, the second one was just bewildering. I had nothing to do with it. I mean, I didn't even own it anymore.
I think a lot of people have the misconception that writers are involved. They rarely ever are.
No, they I didn't, you know, the studio maintained remake rights, and they just made it again. But a writer has to live. I mean, you know, so you're going to have to do something. You're going to have to get a job at a university, or you're going to maybe sell an option or two to your novels or your stories. I wouldn't begrudge that anybody. Mm-hmm. You have to pay the rent and feed yourself, and maybe you even have a family, and life is complicated. I think that you just have to stay guarded. You have to, you know, take Hemingway's advice. You drive to the California border, throw your manuscript over the state line, and make a U and keep and just get out of there.
You know, it is interesting for you you've written 11 novels, you had a ton of success, as I mentioned, two-time National Book Award finalist, but you've also, like, you've been a professor, you've done a journalist, yes. You've done other stuff.
That's, yeah. Right.
Do you call yourself novelist first and foremost?
Yes, I do. But I like to do the other things. The journalism is a tremendous amount of fun for me. I did a whole bunch of stuff for Rolling Stone and got to meet some of my rock and roll heroes, like Mark Knopfler and Al Green and Levon Helm, and... You know, it's tremendously exciting to be able to meet these people and get to write about them, and I have taught. I've taught at the Writers' Workshop in Iowa and in a few other places,
yeah.
And I do like to meet the younger writers and see what they're up to. I don't feel completely at one with the whole project of teaching writing. I'm not sure that they're getting their money's worth, but I've enjoyed it, but I'm not regretful that I haven't spent my life on a campus.
Yeah.
I sort of like the way it worked out for me, of just, you know, living sort of outside any system, not living inside the, you know, the studio system or the university system or the corporate system,
yeah.
just being my own little universe of one and writing.
My last question, as we wrap up here, you know, you grew up on the South Side of Chicago. And like I said, I mean, this book starts in Chicago, the first couple meets at a art fair, neighborhood art fair. Do you consider yourself a Chicago writer? I mean, you spent a lot of the main part of your life and wrote most of your books in New York, all your books. But do, you know, being from Chicago, do you at all sort of identify as a Chicago writer?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure, you know, how I identify. I'm not sure that I would identify as a New York writer either. I might at this point be an upstate New York writer, since I've set several of my books in this little fictional town that's more or less based on the town that I live in. But I sometimes wish that I were a Chicago writer.
Let me put it this way. Is there anything about your upbringing and being born here in Chicago on the South Side that informs you as a writer?
Absolutely. And there's something about coming from the middle of the country, you know, coming from a working class family, living around, you know, quote unquote, regular people, that gives me a kind of cultural confidence that I feel I can speak, I can write about a whole range of people. I feel that there's a reality, at least an American reality, that you get being born and raised here that you wouldn't necessarily have if you were born and raised on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Right.
Scott Spencer, the two-time National Book Award finalist, critically acclaimed novelist, 11 novels, his first in 1973. His latest is called River Under the Road, and he will be reading and signing books at Bookends and Beginnings in Evanston tomorrow night. He lives in upstate New York, but he grew up right here in Chicago. Mr. Spencer, thank you so much for taking some time out to talk to us tonight.
Thanks, Justin.
Thanks, Rob. It is The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Rolling along tonight, rolling along this whole week. It's Lollapalooza coming in tomorrow. Starts on Thursday this week, or this year, huh? They just keep expanding. It's like Cubs night games. Pretty soon it'll be a 42-day festival.
Yeah, like you were talking about yesterday.
Yep.
It's taking over the city. It's, yeah.
Right?
It's creeping.
They're going to, and you know what's going to happen next? There's going to be a city council measure that says the downtown area will no longer be called downtown Chicago. It'll just be called Lollapalooza. And then they'll carve it out to annex Grant Park, and then it'll just be like a bubble. You can't get in. They'll actually bubble it, and there'll be a $35 cover charge just to get in there. And then, you know, it'd be nice.
Yeah.
Nice vegetation, things like that. And always a band on stage.
As somebody who is not going this year, I'm kind of hoping for a bunch of rain tomorrow afternoon. Because then, you know, you get the muddy field, and then you get the stories about all, you know,
how
they have to clean it up, and they ruin the park. And
that's like such a go-to Chicago story, right?
Yeah.
The Lollapalooza is gone, but look at the mess left behind. Let's go out.
Yeah.
Let's go. Dana Kozlov standing by. The mud was a serious situation. The revelers had a lot of fun, but at what cost? Park District says.
You just keep going, right?
Park District says that it's for $300,000. And then they cut to somebody saying, yeah, you cut up the rose bushes. There's some trouble out, and there's going to be no softball till Thursday, at least. That story is so, it's so like, cue it up. And it always rains. It's, you know, like you kind of, I always think of like around Halloween, there's always going to be that awful sideways rainstorm that's windy and cold, usually happens on Halloween. At Lollapalooza, it's always a torrential, you know, monsoon comes through on August 3rd.
Yeah. They'll have to evacuate the premises at one. Yeah.
That was another one. Where do we go? I don't know, man. They went underground, right? They went into the Millennium Park
parking garage.
I hope the Bucket Boys didn't go down there. I can just think about, hey, let's go down there. Echoing off of the cars, car alarms going off. A bunch of guys with their, I don't know what you call those sticks, those hippies with the hacky sack sticks.
Oh, yeah. They're out there.
I just have a feeling that's what it was like in the parking lot. I was telling Rowan and Anna, I have a bubbling interest in Lollapalooza, thanks to all the great segments we've had on the show and the ones we have coming up here too. But I may be able to find myself with a ticket.
Great.
Yeah. So here's
because you're a media personality.
No. This would be outside of that.
Oh.
This would be someone who's like, hey, I got these extra tickets, blah, blah, blah. There's no clout. There's no favor to it. It's not like Lollapalooza's like, we got to get Justin to the festival. No, it's the exact opposite. They're like, nah, You can't come. But here's the rub, Pete. You know, Julie Szymanski was on yesterday, and she talked about Kidzapalooza.
Yeah.
And that the festival, and I looked this up today, the festival is for 10 and under. It's free. If you have someone who has a ticket, you can bring your kid 10 and under. I hope you can only bring your kid. I don't know if you can bring others. What about bringing my son? Never been to a concert before. 10 years old seems really young. But you go during the day, maybe, and check it out. And it's a festival, and you can see some bands, some nondescript bands that are on stage. Go to the Kidzapalooza stage. I mean, I brought it up in the break to Donnie Medea and Paul Kahn. They're like, definitely.
Yeah.
They go, Perry Farrell had young kids. That's why he set it up. There's tons of 10-year-olds running around.
And think about this. In 10 years, when your son is asked what was his first concert, he can say Lollapalooza with Chance the Rapper as opposed to like Johnny B in the leisure suits and Homewood. You know?
That's hilarious. I saw Styx without Dennis DeYoung.
Right? That's
a pretty cool first concert. Say Chance the Rapper and Lollapalooza.
Although, I don't, maybe like at night it might be a little bit crazy, but like during the day.
I know,
but
here's the problem is that I know that if I were, I have no problem doing a daytime type thing.
Mm-hmm.
If I were in a position where I was by myself, I wouldn't have any issue with a nighttime Chance the Rapper kind of shoulder to shoulder experience. The truth of the matter is that that's what you were going to go to. Like, if I were going to go to Lollapalooza and I have tickets for Saturday, I'm not going to leave before Chance the Rapper, right? That would be the whole reason to go. So how do I go to the 9 o'clock show to see Chance, who my son knows the music, likes the music? That would actually be the experience. Because my fear is that you go from 2 to 5 and it's bands he doesn't know, doesn't care about.
Yeah.
You know, my issue with Lollapalooza is way beyond, you know, I'm not worried about his safety or anything like that. I'll be there for him.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff. Man, I'm not stupid. And we're up to 9 o'clock. We're adults. It's a huge mushroom cloud of marijuana smoke everywhere you go when you're in Hutchinson Field watching a show. You're like, geez, Louise, who snuck that in?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And just being in a position where that exposing a 10-year-old and I know it doesn't affect him health-wise, but it's just like, you know, it's just like a lot of, I'm not trying to be a dad with a capital D here, but there's, you know, illicit behavior that happens when you're deep into a concert with 100,000 people in Hutchinson Field. Now, that's the bad side. The good side is if you have the experience of your first concert to be that kid, Chance, who is a Chicago kid who went, my son goes to the same school he went to.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like there's a kinship in the idea that this kid from Chicago and we watch him on Saturday Night Live and watch him at the Grammys, listen to his music. We like him and he speaks for Chicago. You know, Taylor Bennett was my son had a chance to meet Taylor Bennett. Like there's a lot of opportunity there to have a connection, to be your first concert, to be like, that's really inspiring. And so that's a positive. And then on top of it, if you have been to Lollapalooza and you're in that where he's going to be in that south stage, and you stand there in Hutchinson Field and you look around while No Problems are on or All Night or whatever is being played, Sunday Candy, and you look around and you see the skyline of Chicago. And in from that vantage point, it's magic.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to oversell Lollapalooza because, you know, I take it or leave it. I'm not telling anyone they should go and spend money to go see bands. But that experience of being able to look back, and I think of my experience and your experience of going to Poplar Creek or Alpine Valley, it was lawn seats and nothing.
Yeah.
This is Hutchinson Field, and you turn around, and the skyline from the Sears Tower to Michigan Avenue to the Prudential Building is all lit up. It's magical. It's nothing like, and the architecture around it is stunning. They should be paying triple to have Lollapalooza in Grand Park. Just for that alone, that experience. So I don't want to rob him of that just because I'm a dad with a capital D that's like, okay, who's smoking reefer? You know what I mean?
Does he know what that is? Well,
I don't know if he'll know what it is.
So then he'll ask and you can just say, oh, it's cigarettes or, you know.
Well, 312 says, my husband took our 9-year-old to see Metallica at Lolla.
Mm-hmm.
He had a ball, loved Kidzapalooza. So maybe that's Metallica would be, yeah, it'd be pretty awesome.
Yeah.
And then 779 said, hey, what's wrong with Johnny B?
I didn't say anything was wrong with Johnny B, but it, you know, it doesn't flow like seeing Chance the Rapper.
A young Pete Zimmerman. Where was it? Where would it be? It would be.
I think
like
it was at Poplar Creek. Poplar actually, Creek, yeah.
Hey, is everybody crazy in Chicago?
Yeah.
Oh, don't you know we are crazy in Chicago? A lot of guitar pianos. Or piano guitars. A lot of cool ties.
Yeah, I think I wore a piano tie, actually.
That's what it was. That now, I would like to be the... Do you know how Howard Stern was able to get Sanjaya? Is it Sanjaya? Yeah.
Yeah.
Into the finals. I would love to be the DJ in Chicago that advocates and pushes for a Johnny B in the Leisure Suits reunion at Lollapalooza. A total Chicago band that gets... big billing.
Yeah.
Johnny B in the Leisure Suits. On the North Stage, Friday night opposite Calvin Harris. Right? Don't tell me you wouldn't pay the $175 cover charge for that one.
That depends on who the guest is. Piranha Man going to be there? You know,
it's got to be full lineup. Okay. It's got to be everybody that the whole crew.
Jimmy Budweiser, former employee here.
Absolutely. Yeah. If there's no Jimmy Budweiser, there's no Johnny B in the Leisure Suits.
Buzz.
I mean, there has to. Yeah, we need to do a festival of
Wanna
all.
Start the Facebook page.
We got to start the Facebook page. We got a lot to do tonight. And get the Twitter account set up. It would be a great thing to like get behind to be the show that advocates. We want Johnny B in the Leisure Suits to get to Lollapalooza, finally after all these years.
Maybe we try like Rib Fest first. See how
that
goes.
There's a radius clause. So, you know, they can't play Lala. They can't play within a certain time.
Oh, that's right.
So we got to make sure we follow the rules. We have enough connect. You know, we can get to some of these tastemakers, you know, get the Johnny B demos back in the hands of the guys who, you know, do all the hot bands in Chicago, book all the hot spots. Hey, send this up the chain. Send this cassette up the chain. We're onto something. Yeah, so I don't know.
I say yes. Take the son to Lollapalooza to see Chance. Because, yeah, you'll be next to him.
Yeah.
And there you can find a nice space where it's not going to be crazy.
Yeah, right. And I guess you don't have to get really close up. It's not like we're at that point in his life. We're like, hey, you want to learn the snake?
Yeah.
You want to
learn
how you touch every half-naked body all the way to, like, eighth in row? That's the worst. There's nothing worse than a hot day where... some kid in a basketball jersey whose sweaty shoulder rubs against yours. That's what I'm trying to avoid, right? And I also want to get into a point where he ain't getting on my shoulders. Again, I don't want to be that kind of dad who's like, you can't see?
Yeah, you can't do that.
Let me prop you up. No, get out of here. He's too big. I'm not going to have that. No. We're going to be trying to get up on the hills behind the porta potties.
Yeah.
that's where we want to be. Right? That's where you want to be at Lollapalooza when you got a kid. So, yeah, I don't know. I'm still on the fence. And I will say that one of the issues has to do with, you know, being a dad and wanting to take my son to Lollapalooza is I automatically go, my brain just goes, how do you get out of there when it's over? Like, it's the first thing that goes. I don't know if it's a Chicago thing or if it's just my family kind of thing, but I start stressing about that a half hour into the set where I'm like, should we get closer to the door? How am I going to get back? Am I going to be able to pick up the bus? Is it going to be a train situation? What's traffic going to be like? I mean, it starts to be kind of overtake my emotion in the moment, which is never good, right? That's never good. So I'm already figuring out the plot and the plan for that. Like, what do you do when... your brain is completely fixated on the idea of how do you get out when the show's over? And that's all I'm thinking about, Pete. That's it. Like the minute I started thinking about, oh, Lollapalooza, I could take my son. Oh, but how do you get back? Do you take the train? Do you already into like the exit plan? Maybe I could park here or something and just kind of figure out a way to walk out of there. You know? That's the other thing too. I just don't want to be with the. I don't want to be with the unwashed.
You don't have to stay for the whole thing.
Oh, that's true. But you know, this is the. I agree with you, but it's Chance. on stage at Lollapalooza. And what I know about that kid, what I love about him as an artist, is he is a showman. And he's a present. He presents great music and great performances and great events.
Mm-hmm.
So I guarantee when he comes out for the last two tracks, whatever he does, he's going to be like, ladies and gentlemen, Lil Wayne. Ladies and gentlemen, 2 Chainz. You know, or ladies and gentlemen, Kanye West. And you'd be like, I don't want to be the guy who leaves the Bears game early.
Yeah.
You know, and misses that opportunity.
Do you care about it?
I do care. I would love to see that. Yeah, I do care about
it. Okay, then that's different. Because I was like, if you don't care, like, yeah, you know, he leaves the stage the first time, you rush out of there before, the encores.
Right.
And you know, you can kind of, because I think they have to be out of the park by 10.
Yeah, it's only till 10, right? It's a little bit after his bedtime. But 6'3 Yoga's, my dad took me to a Pink Floyd concert when I was 11, and I said to him, hey, who's smoking weed? Your son may know more than you think.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And if he said that to me, I'd be like, what are you talking about? Nobody is. They're drinking milk. No, something like that. No, but I guess right now, I mean, if it all plays out and I can't get the ticket and I can do it on Saturday, I'm going to miss. I was going to go out on a double date to see Girls Trip. It was a very exciting moment. See Girls Trip. But that might have to go on hold if I can go to Lollapalooza instead.
Yeah, I mean, that'll be out next weekend.
That is true. Yeah, I mean, I've been making a big deal. I've been making a big deal about how I want this summer, this August, to be a really full, special one for me and my son. Meaning I want to do a lot of summer-type things.
Mm-hmm.
Every moment we have, you know, his camp is ending, and so now we have more time together, and it's like, we're going to go up to the Wolf River. We're going to whitewater raft.
Yeah.
I think we're doing one kind of half day at the Dells out of that. It's a whole thing.
Terrific.
I'm still intrigued with some sort of day trip experience. We have our vacation at the end of August. I'm thinking about going up to Door County, something like that. So there's like a whole thing that I want August to be like one of those.
Well, I think kicking it off with Lollapalooza is a pretty good start.
Yeah. Mary says, I understand being on the fence about taking your son to Lollapalooza. To reduce your stress, maybe you should head for an exit like 10 minutes before.
Yeah.
I think for your son, that would be a lot less stressful. Just remember. Then Mary goes on, well, remember the weather. You're not going to need a shield, maybe some sunscreen. A lot of water,
yeah.
Stay deep.
All that, yeah.
And make sure you bring snacks. I got that part. That's
got that down.
I also don't want to be the dad's like with the fanny pack on. It's like, do you got any fruit? You need fruit roll-ups? We'll be all right.
Hey, I sat next to a couple at the Cubs game that was eating. They were eating ribs at the Cub game. They brought their own ribs in.
Wow.
So
you can do that.
Apparently,
I guess it's true. I feel like when I went to Cubs games in the 80s, my mom would bring ham sandwiches.
That's different.
Yeah.
Not a slab of ribs. You're sitting right next to a guy licking his fingers. So, I mean, you know, there's worse things than bringing
They just drop the bones? Yeah. They just put them on the...
Yeah,
oh,
the
no,
bones are under the seat, so somebody has got to pick up the bones.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
That's like that's on par with wings on the bus.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
Yeah, you can't be eating ribs at Wrigley Field. Come on.
Yeah.
Like homemade ribs.
I didn't know what they were doing. They put out the styrofoam, and all of a sudden, the foil, they started, unfurling the foil. I'm like, wait a minute, this is ribs you're eating? So there could be worse than being
be
the dad that's going to bring the snacks and stuff to Lollapalooza. I think that's fine, too.
Yeah. 847 is Mary again. I think it's a good opportunity for both of you. All it takes is some planning to make it more pleasant and try to prevent problems. It sounds like possibly the wrap on a infomercial, like that would be in the Vegas hotel.
Yeah.
All it takes is some planning to make it more pleasant. Try to prevent problems. Next up, a new magic show takes over at the Wynn. Mary said, "Hey, Mary makes a good point about all the things because she kind of was like, "Hey, don't mock. That's good advice, right? About bringing snacks and shoes and things like that." And it made me think, I'm like, yeah, you know what? I would totally be such an aloof dad in that moment. I'd be like, are we going to Lollapalooza? Let's go. Oh, yeah, you should probably put on shoes. And we get there and he'd be like, I'm hungry. I'm like, do you want a Coors Light? I think you can get a taco in a bag Yeah, you don't eat that. Well, we'll eat later. That would just be the worst.
Yeah, day. that's gonna turn out to be a bad experience.
Yeah, I need to prep it up, bring a backpack.
Yeah, exactly.
Not be afraid to have it checked.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Right. All right, coming up, Greg Flamm. He's in the building and he's got a new Bears poster. Yay! 312-981-7200. We're playing Swap Meet tonight. If you'd like to have your collectibles, your valuables, your junk evaluated live on the radio, you can. If you just want to brag about something cool that you've collected over time, that's my favorite part about this.
It's time for Swap Meet. Oh yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
And Greg Flamm.
Let's do this.
All right, it's the Swap Meet here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. At DuPage Picker, Greg Flamm on Twitter and Facebook. This is a segment we do every Wednesday night where we take your calls and texts, talk about your collectibles, your memorabilia. We evaluate your junk. Gross. 312-981-7200. Or you just call up to brag about what you got. I love that part. That's my favorite part. Greg, good to see you, buddy. How are you?
Good to see you. Thanks, Justin.
All right. So, you know, we always start the episode with what you brought in.
Sure.
This is a strong time, still a strong time. We start the beginning of August. Great garage sales everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, Monday, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, it's not just a weekend thing during the summer. So you can, you know, if you work on the weekends, you can go out during the week and look for some stuff. This past week was more a selling week than a picking week, you know, with Wolf's Flea Market in Rosemont. But
who is also the sponsor.
Yeah, we love them. They're great. And I mean, over 500 vendors. I mean, that place is just insane. I mean, I love it. I go there for selling or buying. I mean, you can get almost anything you want, from food to antiques. You know, they have seven like food trucks set up. It's like a festival. It's not just hot dogs or pizza. I mean, you can get like, you know, some pretty good food, you know. Anyway, not
you're going deep
digress.
On this.
Yeah. I am.
You're going deep on the food.
I know. And people know me. They know that. But yeah, so I brought in some, you know, the weekly Bears poster and
yes,
some other stuff.
Let's start there. This is a standard.
Yep.
Framed. Big. This is the big one where everyone's standing.
Yeah, I should have enough to get us through the first preseason game.
Look at this. Yes, that's what I'm talking. World champion Chicago Bears.
Yeah, this was a good one.
The team photo from 1986. So essentially the camp photo after the camp breaks, photo after the Super Bowl. Look at those guys. Look at the swagger.
Yeah, and
look at the high-waisted white pants.
It's probably in the top seven of all Bears posters, and it's not worth a ton, but it's a good $25, $35 poster, man. Only because they made so many, and it is sponsored by WGN. So.
Yeah, of course it is.
And
look at the collars on those coaches.
Yeah, and just an all-star cast. When you
look at
there.
That all-star cast.
Yep.
So. I love it. I love the look at Tom Thayer there. He's got the gray shirt underneath.
Yep.
Hampton, chest out.
Yep.
Look at that. Zach, strong.
McMahon,
strong.
Duerson, Peyton, Anderson. I mean, it just goes on. Dent.
Real nice suit for Michael McCaskey there.
Yep. Moorhead.
Where's Dicka? I'm looking for Dicka.
The coach up left.
Oh, yeah. Oh, there you go. Yep. The coaching staff has got the V-neck blue sweaters with the white collared shirts underneath. This is a style.
Yeah, it's a great
look at
poster.
The style.
And if you notice from the other ones I brought, this one is much bigger than the. As the years went on, they made the poster smaller.
Yeah, they made them smaller, right?
Yeah, so this,
oh,
is
this is a
cool.
Classic, man. I could do the next hour just staring at it.
Right, and what's cool here is it says not pictured Dennis McKinnon and Doug Flutie.
Wait, where's McKinnon?
He's 85, and I guess, I don't know.
He's like, I'm not going to be there for that. Yeah, maybe he's holding out or something.
Maybe Flutie was signed after this
I feel like Doug Flutie was a mid-season guy, wasn't he? Didn't they, or actually, if I'm not mistaken, let me see if I get this right. Didn't the Bears pick up Flutie right before the playoffs? I mean, they brought him in at a certain point towards the end of that season because it was supposed to be Fuller, or it was supposed to be McMahon who was hurt.
Right.
And then they made it. It was a surprise for the playoffs.
It
so
was
like, Doug
kind of
Flutie's going to be the starter.
Yeah,
which was kind of a joke.
And then, of course, as life goes on, you hear the stories of Tom Zach and McMahon, you know, conspiring against Flutie and stuff like that.
All right,
the rumors.
I love it. I love it. Good stuff. Yeah. All right, I love it. Look, okay, what else you got? What else besides the Bears poster?
I brought in some Disney collectibles, like mid-century era, like ashtrays from the tram. They made these with different pictures or artists' rendering of stuff. This is kind of the common one, but I brought them in because you can find these for 50 cents to a dollar, and they'll go for 20, 25.
These are Walt Disney plates.
This is one of my favorite, the Epcot Future World. I like that one. It's kind of cool. Yeah, this one's a little bit more rare.
That looks like something you'd put the pigs in a blanket on. Grandma would put that on when you're watching the 85
Bears. You'll see those at garage sales, and you can pick them up relatively inexpensive. So.
All right.
So, yeah.
All right, let's get to the lines. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. You can text that number. You can also call in. Why don't we go right to the call-ins? Let's go to Charlie. Charlie, kick us off tonight. What do you want to brag about, Charlie?
I got this toy. It's an industrial automaton R2-D2. I don't know when it was made.
What do you mean by industrial? What does that mean?
I don't know. That's just
what does that mean,
name on the front of his... Not sure.
It's just kind of a title they gave it. It really, there's nothing really industrial about it other than maybe the size of it,
Yeah, he's got a campaign, a companion mode. He's got a game playing mode. He's got a navigating mode.
He's also
he's got
a vacuum cleaner
on his own.
Right.
Yeah, it's really bizarre. A troubleshooter.
Do you have the box for it, or what do you have?
No, I have everything except the box, and it is a 100%. I got all the instruction manuals for it. And I've got the booklet that came with it. This is not the instruction manual, but it's the booklet.
Sure.
And the thing has never been used.
Hmm. Yeah. There's quite a few online, and it seems they're selling three or four have sold in the last 5 months in the $30 range, which is really odd.
Okay.
You would think that'd be much more. But there are a lot available that are asking upwards of $200. But it just seems like they're selling, the market's setting the price at $30 without a box, of course.
Okay, so, I got one for you for the Bears because you guys were talking about the Bears.
Yeah, what do you got?
All right, what do you got? Flutie didn't come to the Bears for the 86 or 87 season. He was not with the Bears in 85.
Right.
Okay.
All right, he was not on the team. We went down to watch a football game with Dick, and that's when they had who was the backup to McMahon? Was that Harbaugh?
Fuller? Or
Fuller and Tomczak.
Fuller and Tomczak, yeah.
Then it went to Harbaugh, and that's the one that, Coach Dick ranted about and all that stuff.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
And then, they brought Flutie, and we went to the game. It was a horrible game. It was one of those games where they were kicking the ball. It was like they're kicking a ball, like a steel ball.
Okay.
And we finally left the field, and this one, it was Pittsburgh, this one fan started throwing nuts at us and yelling, Flutie. And I turned around to him and I said, "You throw nuts at me one more time, and you're going to see Flutie."
it's a lot of nerve to throw nuts, here.
Yeah, I'm an old veteran. I just turned around and said, "Really?
Yeah,
yeah,
that's ridiculous."
So, all right,
thanks, Charlie. Appreciate it.
Thanks for calling.
No problem.
All right, there you go. Let's keep going. Let's go to Jim. Jim, what do you want to brag about, Jim?
Hey, how you guys doing?
Hi, Jim.
We used to be part of a medical team. We were giving physicals to the White Sox at their training camp in Sarasota, Florida.
Okay.
Bill Vet comes on and with a bunch of balls and hands us all a ball and says that he's sorry he couldn't stay. He's got meetings because he wanted to take us to lunch. But he says, I'm going to sign the ball for you. Have everybody walk through that door for these physicals. Sign the ball. And he says, I promise I'll take you out to lunch tomorrow to my favorite place in Sarasota.
Wow.
So he signed them and walked off. Mr. Pegleg walked off. And we got everybody, including the groundskeepers and all of that, signed ball by him. Eric Soderholm, Minnie Minoso was there.
Wow.
Got a signature off of him. And then the next day, Bill Vec took us out to lunch.
Wow. That's a great story,
Yeah, pretty neat.
Yeah, as far as the a selling or a value aspect, which is my part of the show, Justin brings the glitter.
I love the bragging.
Right. Obviously, we've talked in the past, the more signatures on a ball kind of brings it down
diminishes
a bit. So, just going forward, if that ever happens, try to get individual signatures. Obviously, if you have, a 20s Yankees team or something like that.
Eric Soderholm was the hot item, and I was surprised to see Minnie Minoso, and it was like, whoa, wait, we're getting it all, including the groundskeepers.
Yeah.
Jim, were you going to lunch with Vec, and was it your idea to put the team in shorts?
or the Coward.
Did you guys bring that up at Sarasota?
No,
you know, it's hot. No, we should be in shorts.
Yeah.
Yes. No. Yeah. It was funny though. The place he took us was that's the went home the circus. And he took us to an Italian restaurant that was owned by a Venezuelan trapeze act. But he loved the food that they made. We got to eat lunch with Bill Veeck, and he bought.
That's awesome.
Nice.
Oh, I would hope he would. Thanks, Jim. Thanks for the call.
That's a good story. Thanks.
Go. Great show, man.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling. All right. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Greg Flamm in studio tonight. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back, and we'll continue with the swap meet. Stay with us. It's a swap meet here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wolf's Flea Market. Greg Flamm at DuPage Picker in studio. You can find him both on Facebook and Twitter.
Yep.
You're not on Friendster.
Nope. Not on Instagram. No. Not on
MySpace. You got a MySpace page?
No, not currently, no.
Huh.
I bailed out one.
It seems kind of weird that you wouldn't. How much for a MySpace page these days, Greg?
That's a good question. You know, it's big in the music scene still, but it obviously regular people kind of died out with it.
Yeah, right. All right. 312 says, all right, here we go. An auto license plate from 1995 with the words Air Jordan, J-R-D-N, Air Jordan.
Yeah, couldn't find anything with that.
What do you think that would go for? He says $20.
Yeah, I'm thinking more, to be honest. I know a little bit about license plates. Vanity seemed to get more than just numbers. But people are doing some interesting things with the plates. They're cutting out the letters, cutting out numbers, and re-putting them together. Some people will cut them out in the shape of states and make a map, you know, try to get one from each state and cut out the shape of the state. So, yeah, there's a big market, and they're selling typical license plate gets about $5 to $10. That plate, I'm guessing, would be in the $30 to $50 range is
Touché.
What I'm thinking. Yeah, right. You might want to hold on to it and maybe try to get him to sign it, you know, run
get
into
Jordan
it.
To yeah. Sign. Yeah, right.
And
he's around.
Yeah, I mean, he's
just
signed.
Go to the Hudson Club on Wells Street.
Right.
He's in the back.
Yeah, wait till he has another confrontation with Ball.
Yeah, right. You know? He's at the Geno's East. You know, he's just hanging out
back
just,
there. You know.
I'm trying to think of like Tip 90s clubs. Anyone can. He's at Circus. Yeah. He's at Crowbar in the back.
Right.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
847 says, I have about 200 copies of Sports Illustrated from the 60s and the 70s. Some in very good condition, some in fair. Any thoughts?
Yeah, they can generally go for about $15. The swimsuit issues go for higher, of course. I've noticed a signed swimsuit issue went for $350 recently.
What? Come on. You know, this game is weird.
I'm going to try to get
you got
the
a, you
name
got a
of
1977
the
R2-D2 toy that's like a big
right,
industrial
tee, right?
And you're like 20, $30.
Yeah.
You're like, you can get $300 for a signed swimsuit issue.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you who the model was if I can read it.
Christie Brinkley's got a bikini on and she signed it. I'm rich!
Right.
Come on.
My phone is locked up here. Anyway, yeah, but, you know, the swimsuit issues, you know, can be 70, 60, 70, even without a signature.
Jeez.
But, yeah, the Muhammad Ali issues are higher.
How about the one when they put, I think it was Rod Strickland from the DePaul Blue Demons in the corner. Like, he didn't get the main one. That might have been, like, a Duke player. But I remember they put the DePaul Blue Demons in the corner.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, I had that one on my wall for a Dallas Comegys.
Who was on the cover of the main cover?
I don't remember who was the main. It was probably one of the Duke kids.
Yeah.
But I think Dallas Comegys got a corner.
Okay.
Or Rod Strickland.
Yeah, I'm thinking $8 probably. Yeah. So
it's in really bad condition.
Just like everything else.
It's ripped. It's duct taped. It's not good.
I hope you're teaching your son to store his toys better.
All right. We have a 708 says we have a set of Cubs glasses. The C is in blue with the white around it. No red at all on them. They're filled with grape jelly with a tin lid. What does that mean?
I could not find that.
What is that?
Maybe they can text in the brand.
So they're like, so is a jelly?
If the jelly's still in there, that'd be interesting to see like what year it is.
But I mean, is it a product? Is it a jelly product with a Cubs logo on it?
I'm guessing because they did the same thing like with you know, cartoon characters, you know, had their character on the smaller glasses of jelly and you pop the lid off and then when you're done you can use it as a glass, of course. So I'm assuming that's what this is, if they can text in more.
There was a time in which jelly was a hot item for sponsorship.
Yeah, a lot of the Hanna-Barbera stuff. I'm trying to think of other characters. Flintstones were big with the jelly glasses. I see them. And, you know, they're pretty easy to get.
Isn't it like jelly you put on a sandwich?
Yeah.
Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, just be a small, I don't know, 8-ounce glass.
I've never heard that.
Yep.
This is where I'm glad I'm young. Right?
Right.
Still, when you're at 42, I'm 42. You can go one way. I can be like, yeah, I'm just like everybody. I'm so old. But then you hear that there was jelly that used to have Scooby-Doo on it or Flintstones.
Yep.
And then you could keep the cup. And I'm like, yeah, I'm a millennial.
Well, the reason they last is because obviously they're thicker glass, so they tend to last longer.
It's weird.
You know, where like the McDonald's glasses were thinner, they would break.
All right. Let's keep going. 815 says, I have a Monopoly game, Lord of the Rings Trilogy Edition, unopened. Is that worth anything?
Yeah, it's looking like they're going for about 80, but you have a lot of competition with that. There's a lot listed, and they're still selling, but they're going upwards of $80.
So would so I'm guessing the game would be like different places. Like you go to the Hobbit patch, Briar patch or whatever.
Right? Yeah, there's probably 100 different versions of Monopoly.
And that would mean like Gollum would be a little piece. He'd be like one of the Thimble, right?
Over my head.
You don't know the word.
I've avoided a lot of that. Don't ask
you really,
me.
If you land
no
on
Game of Thrones, right. don't even
you
go
land
there
on Middle Earth, or yeah. You're on the where the.
I did make a lot of money on Middle Earth item though. One
you
time,
did?
Yeah. Here's my story: is went to an estate sale. There was a couch. I hope we have time for this, but there's a couch of like shades, you know. And I saw this one. It had some printing on it, so I start pulling it out. I'm like, this is like it says Lego Lord of the Rings, and it kept pulling out. I wrapped it back up because I didn't want anyone else to see it because I knew it was like a promo item. Turns out it was the Lego display for the Lego store. This humongous, like 10-foot by 10-foot vinyl, double-sided map of Middle Earth, and it had the Lego logo, and then said Lord of the Rings. And I feel bad because I talked the guy down to $22 for this thing. I ended up selling it to a guy in Sweden for $1,400.
What?
I am not kidding you.
That is a success
story. That is a brag. I don't mind bragging about
that.
They
need to put you on Entrepreneurs Weekly.
That was like 3 years ago. So,
wow.
And that's what got me hooked, you know, into eBay and everything. So
there you go. Greg Flam in studio at DuPage Picker, 312-981-7200. Let's take a break for the news. We'll come back. We'll continue second half. Stay with us.
It's time for Swap Meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure. Like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
And Greg Flam.
Here I am.
There he is. It's at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. Swap Meet 312-981-7200. We are evaluating your memorabilia, your collectibles, some of the stuff that you're about to put in that 25-cent bin at the garage sale. Hold up.
Yep, hold on.
Before you do that, better let us know. Greg might go, that's worth more than 25 cents.
Some of my best finds are in that box for 25
40
cents.
40 cents.
Yep.
Possibly three quarters. I'm just saying. Maybe could 1,500 be. Bucks. We'll see. All right, let's go to Charlie. Charlie, kick us off on the second half. What do you want to brag about, Charlie?
You know what? I have a bunch of china that we actually got inherited.
Okay.
And it's C.H. Field, Haviland, L-I-M-O-G-E-S-C-H. And it's it looks like it's signed by a guy by the name of G.O.A. from France.
The famous Goa.
The famous Goa.
Right.
And you know what? It's really small. Everything's really tiny. It's like
I looked up C.H. Field, it sends it's about each piece is about $17 to $35 per piece. If that helps at all.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Obviously, condition matters, and you know, I don't really see full sets
condition.
Of it.
But you can't get rid of that stuff. It's inherited china.
Right.
You know, the idea that you got to hold on to that china.
No. You know, I just have no idea what it's worth. You know, that's why I called.
I feel like I have china that I got when we got married like years ago, And I just I don't know why it's called. It should just be called thin, unusable plate. Plate that I never use.
Yep.
Like I just like Crate and Barrel type stuff at the top.
You just look at it. Yep.
Display. I don't even look at it. It's
my
like
wife,
it's
my wife has it displayed in like a bureau.
Okay.
And you can't use
but
it.
But it's so small. You know what? You couldn't even even the coffee cups.
Right.
You know, if you put the coffee cups out, it'd be like a gulp and a half.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. They did look small. A lot of them had more of like a aqua bluish or powder blue color to them. But like I said, 17 to 35 each.
These are all white.
Yeah. All white. Okay.
Completely white, gilded, and gold.
All right.
There you go. Charlie, that was Goa's style. Small. He's a small guy. He likes small dishes. Thanks, Charlie.
Well, thanks for calling.
Thanks.
All right.
I like to dig deep into the French China designers.
Right.
There's a whole industry. There's so many. Goa's one of them.
Right.
Jiza is a different guy. All right.
Yeah. And then
let's keep going here. 219 says, I have silk pillowcases with fringe from World War II.
Hmm.
My father was stationed in California. Postcards signed by movie stars from the canteen, the ISO. Are they worth anything? Let me rephrase. Are they worth saving? That's what 219 says. And are they worth anything? Are they worth saving?
I mean,
I'd save
the postcards for sure. I don't know what the pillowcase deal is, but I'm trying to find that now.
A silk pillowcase with fringe. Make that.
Right. I mean, I don't understand how those went together. Was he storing the postcards in the pillowcase?
Yeah. Right.
I don't know. But the postcards are definitely worth saving. Obviously, we've had other people call with signed postcards, movie stars from 40s, 50s.
Yeah, keep that stuff.
Yeah, so.
All right, 219's on the postcard theme. You ready for this?
Yep.
Chicago's sad history, Eastland disaster postcards. What?
I know.
And they say, who would send these? Yeah, there's a picture. There are action shots of pulling people out and the boat on its side. I mean, of course, the Eastland disaster, one of the worst maritime accidents in Chicago history, right on the Chicago River. Yeah, but there are postcards. Yeah, miss you from Chicago.
Right. That doesn't, I don't know why they would even make a postcard like that. But
do Eastland disaster memorabilia, think collectibles like that, does it go for a lot?
It is collectible. I can't give you a dollar amount this second, but...
But just in general.
Yeah, I mean, like Eastland is collectible, yeah.
Yeah.
It definitely is. I just don't understand why they would take disaster and make them postcards out of that. I could see Eastland...
It's a big thing. Big thing in the early days.
Yeah, but terrible Chicago history there.
Yeah, there you go. 630 says, not 100%, but I have sets of most car auto manufacturer brochures available at the Chicago Auto Show from 1983 to 1990. Awesome brochures from Porsche, BMW, GM. Very cool to see the advertised new corporate technology, spotlighted brands and models. Probably a dime a dozen. I'm not selling, but just curious. Jerry.
Well, they're definitely more than a dime a dozen. I do collect that kind of stuff as well. I collect the auto show booklets, the concept cars is what he's talking about. And some of that is $8, but occasionally you can get something in the $30, $40, $50 range. The 80s Porsche stuff, I can tell you right now, goes for pretty good money.
Oh, really?
In the $30 to $40, and in any of the 80s Porsche models.
Who's buying that stuff? Wall Street guys?
we live in their...
they're like, man, I love the 80s Porsche.
Yeah.
That's the only time I ever think of it. I think synonymous, right? The 80s Porsche?
Yep.
The 80s Porsche is that guy, like the guy from American Psycho.
Yep.
Right? That's my vibe I get from the 80s Porsche.
Yeah. But yeah, the
that
80s
or the
Porsche
villain
well.
in like a Revenge of the Nerds or something like that. The villains.
Yeah.
The 80s movies.
And Risky Business was in their portion there.
And there was a portion there.
Yeah. So, but 80s Porsche is collectible for sure. And
all right.
So, yeah. But any of those brochures, especially, 50s, 60s, the concept cars, they're worth, 10, 20 bucks.
847 says, I have a stereo realist 3D viewer that's over 60 years old. Bulb and batteries work, but the wires don't. Worth anything? What's a stereo realist 3D
kind of like
viewer?
A,
what is that?
It's not as crude as a ViewMaster, with the reels. It's a little bit more involved than that. But I've noticed sold.
It's OG virtual reality?
Yeah, and it, right, back in the
Orson
Welles days, But yeah, they're going for about $285, so that's not bad. And okay. If it works, it could probably get more.
The wires don't work on this one.
Yeah.
So maybe that's going to bring the price down.
It could, yeah. But that's still a good
option. Yeah, you don't need
wires.
You know
right,
what?
We don't need a wire.
As Doc said in Back to the Future, where we're going, we don't need wires.
Right. Everything's wireless now anyway.
630 says, I have a beta edition Black Lotus. What is that? What's a Black Lotus?
Okay, I'm beta not really edition. Into this, but apparently it's Magic the Gathering, and it's MTG for those in the know. And apparently he has one of the like beta cards, like a handful that they put out. They're really rare. One sold recently for $7,000.
What?
Yeah, so...
What?
He kind of knows, I'm sure, what he's got.
And, that's why he's telling us. He's bragging about it.
It's a brag, and that's great, you know. But yeah,
wow. Magic the Gathering. I made a mistake. I should have got into that.
Yeah, I like to sell that stuff. I'm not really into it, but I know it has a really good following, and it sells. So I tend to pick that stuff up when I find them.
Wow. 312-981-7200, the phone number. Let's go to Mike. Mike, you're on the line. Mike, what do you want to brag about?
Yes, I've got five baseball cards from 1976, Topps Chewing Gum, the Sporting News, all-time all-stars. Ooh. Rogers Hornsby, Hornus Wagner, Ty Cobb, Pie Trainer, and Babe Ruth.
But these are 1976 baseball cards that are throwbacks to those players.
Right. They're in pristine condition.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I'm sure that's worth something because that's, you know, 40 years ago. But I will say... I never thought that the cards that came in Topps or any others that were throwback cards, like saying, remember these players? Those would be less than the actual cards that were out when those players played, right?
You're right about that.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, back in the 20s, right.
Right.
And they do baseball cards for Babe Ruth when Babe Ruth was playing?
Yeah, I think they were, what, like cigar wrapper, you know, like for tobacco.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
they were more
right.
tobacco cards than gum. I can't find those names they threw out, but 1976, you know, cards, they don't seem to really be going that much. There are a handful, and if they're signed, obviously they're more.
Right.
But you're in the probably 8 to 12 on average.
Right.
And with that throwback card, I just don't know that card. Yeah. I'm not familiar with it.
All right, thanks, Mike.
Okay, thanks again.
Thanks for calling.
I would say if he had a 1976 Freddie Lynn
right.
like I did. Terrible condition, though.
Of course.
Like when the card gets wrinkled.
Yeah, and you put it in your bicycle spokes. That's a bad thing.
In my case, you know, and I'm sure this is. I had a bag of. I love baseball cards. I play mm-hmm. games out of it. It was original OG fantasy baseball, right?
Yep.
Play games, everything like stack the cards, Padres versus Cubs, and statistical, all that kind of stuff. But the problem is that I would put them in a huge paper bag, and I put those paper bag like at the bottom of my. Like room or whatever, and then when we would have flooding or things like that, they would just get wet.
Right, and then stick together.
Yeah, and then they dry out, and they'd get that kind of like crinkle dry kind of look.
Right.
So are those worth anything?
And even if they don't get wet, then the corners are bent, and right.
You can start problems. To like almost split the back from the front. Yeah. Those aren't worth anything. That should be what's worth something. The original pristine, that's boring.
Right. I'm sure someone would buy it to repurpose it somehow, do like a...
I don't know, man.
Paper mache project on a door or something. I don't know. People are doing that with doors these days. They're making them into tables. And
yeah. I just think that there should be a change in the direction of collectibles. It used to be all pristine and everything is perfect. I think you want to go the more damaged, the better. That's just my improvement to your business, Greg.
Right. And that's what they call rusty gold. That's, you know.
Rusty gold. New segment on Thursdays.
After ambiguous.
Ambiguous swap meet.
Swap meet, yeah.
All right. 312-981-7200. I love it. 708 is showing me the Cubs grape jam. They just sent the picture.
Oh, okay.
I've never seen that product in my life. It is a small Chicago glass with a grape jam old top on it.
Mm-hmm.
An actual jelly in there. I've never seen that.
I've never seen it with the jelly in it. Only empty.
630 says, where do I sell record albums?
Oh, geez.
Mainly have great old rock and roll 50s, 60s, 70s, etc.
Yeah, you're right in the wheelhouse with those. I mean, some people just sell them $2-3 each, and don't worry about, you know, some are going to be less, some are going to be more. If you have time to research them, you know, some might be, you know, hundreds of dollars, right, depending what artist you have. But if you have 50s, 60s, 70s rock and roll, you're right there as far as getting some good money. You know, jazz records are doing well, blues records are doing well.
Really?
But yeah, the easy listening or the some of the movie soundtracks, not so much. But
let's bring Elise in. Elise is the woman who texts about the 3D viewer.
Okay.
Elise.
Yes, I heard what you said about it, and where would I put it to try and sell it?
Well, if you had a family member that sells online, they can maybe help you.
Okay.
If you want to write me through the DuPage Picker Facebook page, I can maybe help you or recommend somebody to help you.
You said the wires don't work on this thing, right?
No, the wires don't work.
Okay.
But my in-laws had it for over 60 years, and they thought it wasn't worth anything, and I decided to keep it. And I know you're on Wednesday night, mm-hmm. So I thought I'd check on it.
No, I appreciate that, Elise.
Yep. No, it's definitely worth something. Do you know how many slides you have for it? The actual, like...
I don't think they have any of the slides left.
Okay.
I think they tossed the slides.
Yeah, that might bring it down from the 285.
Yeah, because what are you looking at? Yeah.
Okay.
But it's still, you know, it's still worth probably more than $100, you know, depending on condition.
Mm. Okay, great. I will look and see if there are slides in it.
All right.
Okay, great.
Awesome.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks, Elise.
Thanks for listening.
All right, bye.
The Wires Don't Work. That was actually the Verve's original song. And then Richard Ashcroft, he changed it to Drugs Don't Work later.
Okay.
But it used to be Wires Don't Work. It was a big alternative rock hit.
And that's
90s.
A B-stage Lollapalooza act.
Yeah,
right?
That's right. That's side stage. The side stage. What happened to side stage? Now it's colored stages, blue stage, red stage, south, north.
That's a lot of running around.
It was one stage and a side stage. And that's where you saw the crazy circus that could do stuff with their noses.
Right. Jim Rose. Yep.
Jim Rose.
Yep. You got it.
The side stage.
Yep.
Let's go to Dave. Let's Dave. What do you want to brag about, Dave?
Hey, I got these two Norelco razors. I think they're from the early 50s. It clearly states in the box it's good condition, velvet padded. They are imported from Holland and made in Holland. Mm. And they're both little double headers, not triple headers, but they're both two distinct different models. And the whole thing's in pretty good condition. I don't know, was Norelco making razors in Japan a little while later? Or?
Yeah, what I'm finding is the $20 range. And what's interesting is because they made the cases like so nice looking, people tend to keep those longer. But they're not worth, you know, crazy amounts of money. But they just, because they look nice, I think what made people collect them or keep them this long.
I didn't know the Dutch made were such marvels of engineering. Were they in fact made in Japan later on or something?
Trying to see.
Maybe here in the States, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know where they make that.
Yeah, I'm trying to find Dutch, but if you send a picture through Facebook, I'll do further research for you.
All I know about razor technology is that it got really exciting in the last couple of years. Triple blades, quadruple blades.
Yeah, crazy.
If you put the guys that were in charge of shaving your face in charge of, I don't know, renewable energy.
Right.
We might have something because they seem to, they really, and they're just progressive.
Yeah, now it's like membership programs.
16 blades. Thanks, Dave.
Yep.
All right.
Thank you for calling.
The Norelco guys should get a Peace Prize for their work. Triple blade technology.
Yeah.
Then you see those commercials, you're like, all right.
Really?
Yeah, break. Oh, it lifts and then it cuts?
Right.
Oh, that's amazing.
And cuts again before
it
the...
It cuts again. Before it comes the back hair around retract, and gets you? Yeah.
How
are you
is that
kidding
possible?
Me? Rick, what do you want to brag about, Rick?
Hey, I've got a charcoal painting sketch of the old ballpark, Comiskey Park, with the being torn down. And it's got, next to it, it's got the new park going up. And on the ground, it's got a McCuddy's thing on there. Wow. And anyway, I got that framed with two tickets from the very last game at Comiskey Park. They're intact.
Nice.
And then two from the very first night game, still intact.
Nice.
And
it's all in the same
framed
frame.
In with that.
That's smart.
Huh?
It's all in the same frame?
Yeah.
Yeah, nice.
That's really neat the way I had it done. And I had Jack Simmerling re-sign the paint the sketch.
Sketch, right.
So that, because it's one out of 1,000.
Wow.
And this is, so I had him re-sign it.
That's
and
great.
Then he also framed it.
Yeah, it's clearly one of a kind item with all those items framed together. It's hard to put a value on that, but I'm sure it's in the $3,000 to $1,000 range, $300 to $1,000.
That's cool that you did that, though, Rick. That's something great to brag about.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's a beautiful piece. Everybody looks at it. Just, you know, they want it. And I'm like, I'm not giving it up.
There you go, there's your brag.
Rick. All right, thanks, buddy.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's a good one. In the last week of Comiskey Park, I caught a foul ball from Ozzie Guillen. Is that worth anything?
You have paperwork and
I don't have the ball anymore. I lost the ball.
Okay.
I think it was thrown into the same garage bin with all the other balls we play Little League with and just lost track of it. But
in that bucket with frisbees.
Yeah.
And
there's a couple of bad.
But you have the paperwork, though.
But I do have the paperwork.
I got the ticket stub, right? From the game, yeah.
Yeah, I did, had it authenticated when I was 12.
Right.
All right. I have an, let's see. 815. We get to the crazy part of the night. Ready for this one? This is my favorite of all time. Of all time.
Okay.
815. I have a mummified cat.
Oh, wow.
What? It was found in my great-grandfather's barn hayloft about 50 years ago.
Wow.
We think the warmth of the hayloft preserved it. And then my favorite line of the text. Aren't there people who collect these things?
Well, that is true. They do collect that type of stuff. Something for everyone.
Yeah. Can you go to the mummified cat category on eBay?
I am there now. $153.
No way. Yeah. There are people selling this stuff?
Yeah. Naturally mummified. $153 sold on May 6th, it looks like.
You got to be kidding
me. Yeah, that's crazy.
That's goofy.
Another one for $100.
So right in the $100 to $150 range there's your price. A mummified cat that you found in the hayloft. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Is it kind of like is its face kind of like it's doing a like a meow?
It's flat on its back.
Wow.
Is what I'm seeing here.
All right, Roy. What is that? That is crazy.
Shrunken.
All right, Roy, take us back to reality here. Right. Roy, what do you want to brag about, buddy?
Oh, me? Oh, I got through. This is cool. Listen to radio on the phone.
All right.
Actually, I'm just curious. I have a set of 101 Dalmatian figurines. Actually, I have two of them, individually wrapped. McDonald's put them out several years ago. They're in a foam rubber case, but they each have their own space in their spot. Mm. I don't know. Are they worth anything?
And they're McDonald's, you said, right?
Yeah, probably. I mean, they're probably not worth what I paid for them, but
yeah,
I got in just under the wire before they quit offering them.
No problem. Yeah, it looks they're pretty cheap. You can get a whole lot of them for like $7 now. Outside of the, like used, a big lot or the complete set went for $59 recently. So if that helps at all.
Oh, well, now I know I can go cry.
That's all right.
I'm still trying to figure out that mummified cat.
All right. You're not going to beat that tonight.
You're going to have a hard time.
But I would still hold on to them. They're not, total junk where they're 25 cents at the garage sale. But if you hold on to them, they might come back up.
All right. Thanks, Roy.
Yeah.
Thanks,
man. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we're wrapping it up here. We're almost to the end. I love that. That was so good.
Mummified cat.
A mummified cat.
Nice.
All right, here we go. Let's see. A 1940s carved 5 levels, all different, white with gray streaked marble lamp. Mostly white from a distance. Also, I don't have it, but a friend does, and it's wild. A full, unbroken, complete page of U.S. stamps from the 1979 Shah of Iran's father, the first Pahlavi family in power prior to the more known Shah Pahlavi after the... What are you talking about? After the 1979 revolution.
Okay.
That's so specific. So essentially a thing of stamps from 1979.
Right. Pre-revolution, I guess.
Yeah. Do stamps like that go for...
Yes.
Do they turn once you get to a...
Yeah, there's obviously... that's not my forte, but it's people... When I'm selling, people are asking, do you have stamps? I just... don't have them, and because I just don't know enough to buy them, and I don't want to overpay or
All right, Greg Flamm at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter, joins us every Wednesday for the swap meet. Another successful, fascinating, electric swap meet.
Fun.
Greg, great to see you. See you next week.
Thanks, Justin.
That's going to do it tonight for The Download. Coming up tomorrow night, great show. We're going to talk with the directors of An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power. Also, comedians Moshe Kasher and Natasha Leggero. And also, I'm very excited about this, from Sirius XM, DJ Sway. Sway in the Morning, one of the sort of great show. He does the Five Fingers of Death, which is he has different artists, hip-hop artists and others who will do freestyle. It's the greatest thing of all time. Sway coming up tomorrow night. He's going to be in for Lollapalooza. Patty Vasquez up next here. Patty, hello. Good to see you.
Hello, hello. Good to see you, too.
Yeah, right. What do you got on the show tonight?
I have Senator Daniel Biss coming on the air with us right after the news.
Gubernatorial candidate.
Gubernatorial candidate. Yes, I should probably say that. Right, comma. Senator Biss, comma, gubernatorial candidate. Yes.
There you go.
Talk about Senate Bill 1 and how education is funded in the state of Illinois.
There you go. You know, you just taught me something. SB.
SB 1.
I did not know SB meant Senate bill.
Yes, that it originated in the Senate.
Yeah.
So that
I just know that was the nomenclature they used. SB, then the number.
Yes.
I just thought SB was just what I didn't even know what that was. My God. I thought they'd already gone through all the other letters in the alphabet and they're at S and then they've gone through again. Now they're at B. I got it now. I got it. I'm up to speed.
And they've been working on this. Someone mentioned the other day that they've been working on this bill. Senator Menard has been working on this for a while, but another representative was telling me it really has been in the works for more than a decade because we are last in how we fund schools. So
I remember talking to Senator Menard. I would say probably 4 or 5 years just about funding inequity. So they've been on this for a while, and hopefully they get this thing done.
I know. And you know, a lot of people talk about how the city of Chicago schools are mismanaged. And I guess you could look at anything and say, you know, if you mismanage that, you don't deserve the money. And like the Pentagon, did you see when they covered up $125 billion? I guess we shouldn't fund the Pentagon anymore. We should probably just...
I said the same thing in the show. I mean, there you can punish people for mismanagement, and we should have a better system.
It shouldn't
just
be the
elections,
kids.
But
it
can't be the kids. It can't be that we're going to... say up, you have to sleep in it. That's crazy.
I think there are three things, right? Safety, health, and education.
There you go.
And those are our top three things
Nailed
that government
it.
Should be there for. So,
all right, have a great show.
Have a great night.